It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered. I'm home.
You're like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, my God. We're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
God, this dialogue is shit.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and fight me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster. Who are you to doubt El Dandy?
Woo!
I am exhausted. I got 3 hours of sleep last night after that stream. We are in the home stretch. Two more shows to go today. This one, and then we've got NXT TakeOver 36 tonight. This is episode 718 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, August 22nd, 2021. An eventful week that saw three major television returns, starting with CM Punk in Chicago on Friday night, debuting for AEW, the worst-kept secret in wrestling. And last night, Becky Lynch and Brock Lesnar back at SummerSlam, both on the SmackDown side. Even they don't want to have anything to do with Monday Night Raw. I can't say that I blame them. Rampage on Friday was all about CM Punk. The rest of the show was completely missable. And SummerSlam last night was very much a mixed bag. And I will get into both here in a second. Tonight will be the best wrestling show of the weekend. And possibly of the entire week. And that is NXT TakeOver. And I'm going to have predictions for that show in a little bit as well. So you got a lot of content coming your way. I want to thank everybody who has been joining me on the live streams on YouTube. We have blown things up on the channel this week in terms of new subscribers, in terms of new channel members, in terms of everybody who is dropping super chats all week. You guys have made all of this worth it, as exhausting as it all is. You guys have made this a lot of fun, and I hope you will join me for the final stream of the weekend tonight. Even if you don't watch NXT, come on by and hang out. Everybody who made a PayPal donation, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. As you know, $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. And I got a lot of people to acknowledge here this week. We're going to break these up. We're not going to do them all up front because there were so many of them. But Nightstalker Naif Al-Safar, you hear me mention Naif's name on a lot of the streams. He is everywhere that I am, he supports. He joins us. He's in a different time zone. It's usually very, very late or very, very early in the morning where he is. And I just want him to know, for all of his support, how much I've told him this before. But Naif, you are awesome. And I thank you for all of your support. The Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton. John Loose Cannon Lopez. Big Bear, Brian Becerra. Yovan Bruiser Balak. Beast Mode, Brock Joseph. Out of Control, Cody Thomas. Killshot, Keith Hart. The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard. I know he and Mama Eichard were at the United Center on Friday night, having some fun. Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray. The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep. New York Punk, Arnold Modesto. The Firebomber, Craig Foster. Max the Axe Velado, who is in Vegas with his brother Kevin this weekend, but he wishes he had been in Chicago, he says, for Rampage on Friday. The Chicago Screamer. Boy, a lot of Chicago representation this week. Chicago Screamer, Ian Noel Camelotes. He was at the United Center on Friday night. And he says, my phone died halfway through Rampage. The scene was electric. And I got lucky to get good seats. One of my favorite wrestling moments ever. And I got my ice cream bar. Gary, your girlfriend's crush, Smith. I want to shout out Gary. He tweeted me. I'm not usually a betting man. I don't really do bets. But he said, I'll bet you $50 that CM Punk will not be on Rampage Friday night. He was one of the ones holding out that until I see him with my own two eyes, I don't believe that it's true. I think it's all just a swerve. I said, you know what? I'll take you up on that bet. Easiest bet that I ever took. He said if he won the bet and I lost, that I would have to donate to his favorite charity out of Arizona. I said, I'll take that bet. Of course, I won the bet. easiest bet that I could ever take. But I doubled the money and I did donate to Save the Family in Arizona. I want to give them a shout out. It's apparently a charity that he thinks very highly of, and just, you know, briefly looking at what it is that they do, it is a great cause, and I, you know, tweeted him the receipt so he can see it. And so, Gary, thank you. That was a very nice thing for you to suggest, and I hope you're doing well. Shout out to Marcel Williams. Showtime. Marcel Williams. Paradise Pro Wrestling is making its debut on Fight TV with its Rumble in Paradise show, August 28th at 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific. This is going to be a big night for them, and Marcel is going to be part of the Rumble in Paradise match, with a winner headlining Diesel Mania 5 in September for the PAPW Championship. Again, that is Paradise Pro Wrestling. Check out Rumble in Paradise, August 28th at 7 Eastern. We will have some more shout-outs, as I mentioned, coming up here in a little bit. But let's start from Friday night, and then we'll go in order here, because this was the big wrestling event of the week that everybody was looking forward to. Everybody I heard from was looking forward to. People were counting down. They couldn't wait for the day to end on Friday. It's been a while since we've really felt that way about something, where I actually was looking forward to a show so much that it looked like time was moving like at a glacial pace. I couldn't wait to just get this show over with, frankly, so all this talk and chatter about CM Punk would finally be over. But finally, we got to Rampage on Friday night at the United Center before the largest crowd in AEW history, nearly 15,000 fans, which they will break 4 weeks from today at Arthur Ashe. If you're Tony Khan, you know that you've delivered a home run when even Jim Cornette cannot find a bad word to say about what you did, and says that he doesn't think he's ever heard a crowd reaction like that in his life. And there were some people who were saying, oh, you're overrating it, Solomonster. I mean, Jim Cornette, not exactly the biggest AEW fan in the world. He's been around for a few moments in his day, and even he was struggling to come up with a moment like this in front of a crowd that was this electric. And the way that AEW handled this was perfect. They didn't try to swerve us. They didn't try to be cute. They didn't send somebody out there to Punk's music as a heel to get heel heat. That would have been the wrong move to make. Yes, it would have been very amusing for many of you to see that, but it would have been the wrong move for AEW to make. You had a major, major return of a name who has not been around in 7 years. And the first time his music hits, you know that crowd is going to come unglued. You do not waste that moment by then having them turn around and boo, and then you send the guy out there, but now maybe the reaction isn't quite as strong because they're not sure if he's really going to come out this time. You don't play around. Sometimes the easiest thing to do, just give the people what they want. And in this case, that is what Tony Khan and AEW did. Show went on the air. They introduced the announcers. They brought Jim Ross in for the festivities to join the announce booth, which again had four people, which I will continue to maintain is too many. You do not need four voices in the booth. But they played Cult of Personality, and the place erupted. And out comes CM Punk. This was a reaction like I have not seen in a very, very long time. This is one of the all-time reactions to a return or a debut. Obviously, being in Chicago made it that much louder and that much more special. It's why they booked that building in the first place. This was tremendous. And Punk came out, he soaked it all in, he got in the ring. And just some quick highlights here from the promo. I have a full review of all of this. It is up on the YouTube channel. I did push the audio out to the feed as well. But we'll give the cliff notes here. But he came out and he said that for 7 years, he has heard the crowd chanting his name. And he says that if he ever disappointed anybody for the decisions that he made in the past and stepping away the way that he did, he understands how people might be upset. but he was not going to let himself stay in a place that was destroying him physically and emotionally. I was never going to get healthy if I stayed in the same place that got me sick in the first place. And I know some people say, well, you know, why is he knocking WWE? He had a lot of success and he made a lot of money. He did. Punk became a big star in WWE. He was WWE champion for over a year. He met his wife in WWE. But you have to understand that towards the end there, he was absolutely miserable. And he looked unhealthy. You go back and you see the fucking bags under his eyes and just the way he looked. Then we found out about the staph infection, all of that. Right? I don't need to get into that story. Doctor cuts into it and the pus goes flying. Hopefully, I'll spare you the gory details if you're having lunch or dinner right now. The man was in a bad place. The relationship between the two sides did not end on good terms. And then they fired him on his wedding day. So you can understand that he might not have a lot of really warm, fuzzy feelings towards WWE. He didn't dwell on it. If this was going to turn into just the bash WWE promo and he was going to go on and keep cracking jokes, I would have had an issue with that. But you know what? You have to acknowledge it. You can't come out here after 7 years and pretend that all of that didn't happen, because that is part and parcel of why he disappeared in the first place. He had to acknowledge it. He did. And he moved on. He didn't hurl insults. He said, I was never going to get healthy if I stayed in that place. He talked about Ring of Honor. He said that he cried, which he did. His last match, his last day in Ring of Honor, he had tears coming down his face. He says the reason was when he left Ring of Honor, he realized that he was leaving professional wrestling. He looks at that day in August of 2005 as the day that he left pro wrestling. And August 20th, 2021, he returned to pro wrestling. And I don't know why some people got so hot about this. Again, all the WWE, you know, fanboys and fanatics, they took that as a shot. How is it a shot? WWE does not like being called a wrestling company. The executives in WWE have gone out of their way to say that we're not wrestling. We are sports entertainment. We are more than just wrestling. That is what WWE themselves says. If you even say that we are professional wrestling around Vince McMahon, he'll correct you, as he did to Steve Austin when he was on the Stone Cold podcast. So I don't understand why people were so upset about this. Every perceived slight against WWE, they lose their minds. By their own admission, they are not pro wrestling, even though they are. But if you ask them, they're not. That's what Punk was saying. Says he's back now to work with younger talent and settle some scores. Could be with Chris Jericho, could be with Jon Moxley, could be with Colt Cabana. Colt Cabana apparently was not at Rampage. He was not in the building, he was not backstage. I don't know the status of their relationship. I assume that right now there is no relationship. But as long as they steer clear of each other, I'm sure that they'll be able to coexist just fine. But he did exactly what I expected. Called out Darby Allin, which they've been dropping some not-so-subtle teases for that match. And he challenged Darby Allin to a match at All Out back in Chicago on September 5th. And Darby Allin was up in the rafters with Sting, watching as Punk looked up and challenged him. And when he was done, Punk said that, on your way out of the United Center, be sure to pick up a free ice cream bar on me. And I heard from a lot of people who were at the show that night who got their ice cream bar on the way out. I like Darby being the first opponent for CM Punk. And there can be no doubt now what the main event is going to be at All Out. It is not Christian Cage challenging Kenny Omega for the AEW Championship. The main event of All Out is CM Punk's first match back in the ring in 7.5 years against Darby Allin, who himself is one of the biggest stars in the company, one of the biggest baby faces on that roster. That should be the final match, but wherever they position it, last, second to last, that is the main event of the show. That is why you can get by with Christian Cage as the opponent for Kenny Omega, because they didn't have access to Adam Page. Now they have a real main event. And during his promo, Punk was wearing a new shirt, which looked very similar to his WWE shirt. He had that white ringer shirt. Immediately, before the show was even up, probably before the segment was even over, shopaew.com pro wrestling tees all crashed. You couldn't get on that website. Into the following day, the websites were still down. And I heard from people who were in the building who said that there was a line a mile long circling the entire length of the United Center. People were trying to buy this commemorative I Was There CM Punk t-shirt. Per PW Insider, the reaction from within WWE, for those who are interested in wondering what do the brass in WWE feel about CM Punk coming back, they were expecting this. They heard from some in the company who were very dismissive of the debut, even though they had not seen the segment at that point. They were very dismissive of it. It's not a big deal. We don't care. But then there were others who felt that they completely missed out by not having that moment for themselves and repairing that bridge with Punk and bringing him back in. And as I've said, if WWE wanted to get CM Punk back, I believe they could have had CM Punk. I don't think that bridge was irreparably damaged. I think if they wanted to get down on bended knee and make amends with CM Punk for their past sins, as he sees it, and just say whatever they felt they needed to say to make him feel good, if they thought it was best for business, and they could make a lot of money with him, they could have had CM Punk. They obviously didn't want him. They didn't make an effort to go after him. And it's true. I mean, that moment we saw on Friday night, if you're WWE, that should have been their moment. And they squandered it. And their loss ended up being AEW's gain. Now, they had a post-Rampage media scrum. Tony Khan was sitting next to CM Punk as they were fielding questions from the various wrestling media folk. Tony Khan looked like a little kid sitting next to Punk. He had the cheesiest smile on his face the entire time. It was great. He looked like a fan, right? I mean, he is a fan. So, I mean, if the shoe fits, that's what he looked like. He's made no bones about the fact that Punk is someone he wanted on the AEW roster from day one. It just ended up taking a little bit longer than they would have hoped, in part because of the pandemic. Punk would not talk about the details of his contract. He would not talk about how long the contract is for. Neither would Tony Khan. The only thing they said is that it is not a short-term thing. It's not a part-time thing. It is a regular full-time contract. Whatever the length is, he's all in. And Punk said, just know that I'm here, and I'm here to help anybody who wants help. He says the talks with Tony Khan went back for well over a year and a half. And there was no consideration given to bringing him in without fans because that would have been insane. Why would Punk want to come back in front of no fans? Or why would Punk want to come back in a 90% empty Daily's place? We would have missed out on a moment like this. Think of how many moments similar to this that we missed out on during the pandemic, whether it was Brody Lee or any of the other people, even Sting, any of the other people and debuts that AEW had and brought in. Good as they may have been, imagine if Brody Lee in his hometown of Rochester, New York had come out that time as he was supposed to do. We missed out on a lot of special moments like that. There was no chance that they were going to bring Punk back or Punk would want to come back until they got people back in the building. And you saw why. You saw exactly why on Friday. You only get one. That's really all you get. When you're gone for 7 years, that will never happen again for CM Punk. He is not going to disappear for another 7 years, and at the age of 51, he's going to come back and have a big moment like that. So you only get one moment like that in your career. He was not going to squander that. Punk said he's sure that he's going to do a little bit of everything, wrestling, commentary, whatever they want him to do. His deal does allow him to continue doing MMA commentary and other outside projects and movies. He wants to end up in the old Terry Funk role, where he ends up becoming the veteran who helps others and works with young guys and tries to help put other people over, and that's the role he envisions for himself. He said, from the moment the original ECW died, he's heard of people who were going to start running a new promotion, and we've got a lot of money behind it. And of course, most wrestlers rightfully are very skeptical of that. You hear stories like that all the time. Oh, this is going to be the next big thing, or we're going to be bigger than WWE, and we've got a financial backer. So he was skeptical when this whole AEW thing first started. But he and Tony Khan were talking for an extended period of time, and you know, the more he got to know him, the more he got to respect him and understand exactly how serious he really is. And the thing that he pointed out, he singled out this event as far as AEW is concerned and wanting to be part of this locker room. He mentioned Brody Lee and the fact that when Brody Lee got sick, his wife spoke to the locker room and asked them not to share the details of what was wrong. She wanted it to be kept private. And if that were any other wrestling locker room, and he didn't specifically say WWE, he was kind of alluding to that. WWE is a very big company with a lot of people in it. He said if it was any other company, that shit would have been on the internet within a day. Or less than 24 hours, that stuff would have been leaked online somewhere. And that was not the case with AEW. Everybody respected her wishes. They all worked together to keep this a secret as long as they could. And nothing leaked before he passed away. And that was something that he took note of as far as the kind of locker room that they have put together here in AEW. So he listed a bunch of names. The Young Bucks, Kenny Omega, Ricky Starks, Will Hobbs, Jungle Boy, Jon Moxley as possible future opponents. He says, who knows who might join the company soon? Wink, wink. He said it was Tony Khan's idea for his first program to be with Darby Allin. And as far as the possibility of stepping through the forbidden door, Punk, he did not really give a straight answer. He says, I'm an AEW guy. But he also joked that if Tony Khan wanted him to go work the G1, they could talk about it. That's something I honestly had not given any thought to. The possibility of, you know, maybe next year, CM Punk in the G1 climax. That would be interesting. So anyway, I thought that they hit a home run on Friday. The rest of the show was very forgettable. I thought the tag team match on the show was good, but honestly, the rest of the show is completely forgettable. Just a total nothing burger. It was all about Punk. You could have just put him out there and gone off the air half an hour later, and that would have been, you know, that would have been fine. So not a very strong show outside of the Punk stuff. There were comments that Roman Reigns made about CM Punk this week. He was asked a question. I just want to bring this up briefly here because it did become a story and it made headlines. Roman Reigns was doing an interview with Ariel Helwani for BT Sports. And he was asked for his opinion on part-time WWE performers like John Cena coming back to the company and taking a spot in the main event and headlining. And in asking the question, Ariel referenced CM Punk, who I think they may have just talked about in another part of the interview. But he again referenced CM Punk and comments that Punk made many years ago in his pipe bomb about part-timers coming back and taking up main event positions. If you remember, that was the issue that Punk had with Dwayne. That was the issue he had with The Rock. And it was a worked shoot promo, but there was a lot of honesty and a lot of genuine feelings that Punk really had in that promo, and that was one of them. Roman, in response, and I don't believe this was in character. Other things he said sounded in character. I think this was just his honest thoughts on the situation here. Maybe he was playing it up a little bit, but he said, those statements are coming from bitter people who possibly thought they were better than they really were. When it comes down to it, CM Punk was not as good or as over as John Cena. He was not as good or as over or move the needle like The Rock. It just was what it was. From a full-time performer, I understand the frustration of wanting more, but like I said before, you've just got to take it. And that led to a lot of divided opinion over what Roman Reigns had to say. There is a lot of truth in what Roman Reigns said in that statement. CM Punk was not the needle mover that The Rock was. He's right. CM Punk was not the needle mover, by and large, that John Cena was. That's true. Those are facts. He's not wrong when he says that. I think the issue is, though, that the same can be said for Roman Reigns. So for him to be the one saying it is kind of rich. It took this company over 6 years to get it right with Roman Reigns. And even today, as much as I love the work that he's doing, I think it's the best work of his career. He really is the biggest attraction, full-time attraction in this company right now. There is not a lot of evidence that Roman Reigns is any more of a needle mover than CM Punk was when Punk was at his peak. You know, when you compare both of them to the really big names like John Cena, who carried this company for so many years because they just, either they didn't have anybody else or they didn't allow anybody else to rise up to that level. But without Cena, they would have been sunk. So yeah, when you compare even Roman Reigns to John Cena, you compare Roman Reigns to The Rock, it's the same situation. He and Punk are in the same boat. So I see it as less of any sort of indictment of CM Punk, and I see it more a case of WWE either not being able to create that level of star again or just not allowing it to happen. I think it's a little bit of both. I think they lost their charm a long time ago when it came to trying to create these big megastars, but I, as I've said many times, I don't believe, I'm not convinced that they want that. I think John Cena may go down as the last of that breed. Of someone who, you know, kind of felt like he almost transcended the company and transcended the business and became this big name. And now, of course, he's off in Hollywood. I don't know that we're ever going to get that level of star again in this company because I don't think they want that. I think they want to, you know, maintain more control over these talents that, in their view, you know, we make them, we create them. And we've sort of got to keep the monster caged. Don't want them to leave and go away. I mean, they had that in Brock Lesnar. I guess Brock Lesnar would be the closest thing to like this big kind of megastar that they had. But he was also a part-time performer. He was not a full-time guy. And he gained notoriety outside the company from his MMA days. He came back to WWE in 2012, a much bigger name than he was when he left in 2004. That is indisputable. Outside of Lesnar, there is nobody close to that level right now in WWE. Not one person. So for all the truth in Roman Reigns' statement that Punk was not as big as The Rock, for example, I mean, few people are. I mean, can you really, I'm not going to hold that against CM Punk. He's part of a long list of names that you could put on that list from the last 20 years who are not quite as big or at the level of The Rock. But Roman Reigns, it was almost like he was making these comments looking in a mirror. He and CM Punk have more in common, I think, than he lets on here in that statement. Now, SummerSlam last night featured two major names returning to television for the first time in more than a year, and two matches that delivered big, but the rest was a mixed bag, and there were, frankly, a lot of boring moments on this show. A lot of boring moments. I've never seen a crowd outside of some of those Japanese crowds who react in a totally different way than they do here in the States. I've never seen a crowd this big. They claim 50,000. The number was a little bit less. It was about 45. But I've never seen a crowd with so many people in the building, and yet they sounded so quiet. You know, I mean, when certain big moments would happen on the show, all of a sudden they came alive. But for a good part of the show, they just sounded dead. And a shout out to WrestleTix on Twitter. They do a lot of really good work in terms of ticket sales and ticket updates for WWE and AEW and other promotions as well. And I think they said the final official number for SummerSlam, I believe, was either 45 or just shy of 45,000. Still a very big number, but you know they tend to round up with these things. So they claimed an indoor attendance record for SummerSlam of over 51,000. This show was the definition of the good, the bad, and the ugly. Big E on the pre-show got his Money in the Bank briefcase back, beating Baron Corbin, and then he was never seen again. RK-Bro won the Raw Tag Team titles, as they should have. AJ Styles, would be nice now to see him break away from Omos and start doing singles matches again. Alexa Bliss and Eva Marie, the less said about that, the better. Damian Priest is the new national champion. You might be wondering, did WWE introduce a new title? No. They had some celebrity cameos on the show last night, one of which was comedian Tiffany Haddish, who had one line. She had one job in the back, which was to interview Damian Priest after his U.S. title win over Sheamus, and she referred to it as the national championship. And I'm just wondering, you know, if someone brought me in for a job, and I was going to be positioned in the back, and they said, okay, this is all you're going to do on the show tonight. We're going to bring in Damian Priest after his big win, and here's what we need you to say. Be a no-brainer, right? It's the easiest job in the world. Okay, I can do that. It's not like they're handing me a whole script to memorize. Couldn't even do that. And she's an entertainer, so she should know better. So Damian Priest is the new national champion. And as I said on the stream last night, only the first step of a longer evolution for Damian Priest, who will eventually be the top dog either on Raw or on SmackDown. I think that is where he is headed. Sheamus keeps cranking out really good matches, doesn't get enough credit for it. We then had the SmackDown Women's Championship debacle on this show. And it's a shame, too, because this is one of the two matches I was most looking forward to. So I tend to be a little more aggravated about this because of that. Because this was a match I was genuinely looking forward to. Sasha Banks was not on the show. They made no announcement in advance that Sasha Banks was not going to be there. In fact, they ran the video package for the match right before introducing Bianca Belair. So they knew that Sasha was not going to be there. Okay, clearly they knew this. And they knew it for a while. At least according to Meltzer, as many as 8 days in advance, they knew that Sasha Banks was not going to be there. This was not a last-minute thing. So, whatever the situation is with Sasha Banks, I'm not going to sit here and speculate. It'd be like a Keith Lee thing all over again. I am sure the news will leak, or WWE or Sasha will tell us at some point. Whatever it is, whether it's medical, whether it's something else, she wasn't there. She was not in the ring against Bianca Belair. They sent Carmella out there. And not that that would have been much better, because we've already seen this on television a gazillion times. Bianca Belair has beaten Carmella over, like a drum, over and over and over and over again, like a bongo. But they were about to do the match, and all of a sudden Becky Lynch's music hits, and out comes the man. Becky Lynch back on television for the first time since May of 2020, when she vacated the Raw Women's Championship and announced to the world that she was pregnant, and she was going to go be a mom. And out comes Becky Lynch. She looked good. She's been training hard for her big comeback, posting pictures on Instagram. It sounds like they called her back earlier than they had originally intended to. There were reports that suggested she was not going to be back until October. But there she was on the show last night, kicking Carmella out of the ring and challenging Bianca Belair to a match for the Women's Championship right then and there. Bianca accepts, shakes her hand, and immediately Becky clocks her in the face, hits a rock bottom, and pins her and wins the SmackDown Women's Championship in a matter of seconds. It took barely 25 seconds to end the reign of Bianca Belair, who has reigned supreme in that division since WrestleMania. One of the best matches on that WrestleMania card. A very uneventful reign as champion. But not the way that a lot of people were hoping or expecting for Bianca's run to come to an end. And probably not what they were planning a week ago. But that is what they did last night. And the point that I made on the stream about them knowing in advance, however many days it was, I don't even care how many days it was. It could have been 24 hours. It doesn't matter. Them knowing in advance that this woman was likely not or definitely not going to be on the show last night, and continuing to false advertise one of the biggest matches on the show, the biggest women's match on the show, certainly. There is no reason, and this is the point that I made, and I'm going to make it again here. There is no reason that I need to rely on someone like Raj Geary of Wrestling Inc. or Sean Ross Sapp of Fightful, or Mike Johnson of PW Insider, or anybody else to break these stories, as Raj did. He was the first one to confirm that Sasha would not be on the show last night. There is no reason I should have to rely on these people to do it on social media or on their websites when WWE should have the transparency to do it themselves. Especially when they could have run the exact same angle they did last night. They didn't have to change a thing. I wish they would have changed it. They could have did exactly what they did, but still have been honest with their audience, and they made a decision not to. Not the first time they've done it. They've been doing this for decades. A lot of you even mentioned the whole Steve Austin thing at Survivor Series 99, which was equally bad because even with Austin, they knew days in advance that he wouldn't be able to wrestle on that show. And they chose to false advertise him anyway because they didn't want to lose out on the pay-per-view buys. Pay-per-view buys now are less of an issue with it being on the network. There was no reason for them not to be honest with their audience. And I don't think that that is something they should be allowed to skate on. They should be asked about this. The next investors call, I wish somebody would pipe up and ask them about this practice of false advertising and why they continue to do it even when they don't have to. There is something to be said about building up goodwill with your audience. They don't seem to be too bothered about doing that. They can't really be bothered at all to do that. And that was my biggest issue with what they did last night. I also think, and it was the other problem here, is that this could backfire on them. Unless the plan is for Becky Lynch to go heel, this could blow up in their face. Because what we had last night at SummerSlam was almost identical to the situation we had 3 years ago at SummerSlam involving Becky Lynch, only the roles were reversed. Becky Lynch had been racking up wins on television, and the people wanted to see her win that championship. That was the payoff. Charlotte Flair had been off television for weeks and came back and got shoehorned into a triple threat with Carmella and Becky for the title at SummerSlam in 2018, and she won the title. She, in the eyes of the fans, she stole that title away from Becky Lynch and got booed for it. And when Becky lowered the boom and, quote, turned heel on her and attacked her, the fans reacted like she was a huge babyface. This is a company that genuinely expected that we're going to turn Becky Lynch heel. When they didn't get the reaction they wanted to that night, they spent the next 4 weeks on television having her go out there and cut these ridiculous, nonsensical promos about how the fans didn't stand by me, you guys turned your back on me, which of course anybody with two functioning eardrums could tell that wasn't the case. They were supporting her loudly and very vocally every single week. Finally, they gave up the ghost and they just ran with it, which is what you gotta do sometimes. Sometimes you just have to run with it. Blow up your plans and just go with what the fans are telling you they want you to go with. And Becky ended up becoming one of the biggest stars in the entire business during that whole run. She was the biggest star in wrestling for all those months. Bigger than any of the men they had. Well, now Becky Lynch is the one who comes back after a long layoff and she takes the championship from Bianca in just, you know, storyline-wise, as disrespectful a way as you could possibly think of. She takes this title away from her, and she gloats about it. So, if the fans were to apply the same logic, then on SmackDown Friday night, Becky Lynch should come out to a chorus of boos. How many people are going to be in the crowd booing Becky Lynch? Is she going to get a 100% babyface reaction? Is it going to be 50-50? Are there going to be people booing her now because of this? Because if the plan wasn't to turn her heel, boy, this is a really stupid way to go about handling this. Jinder Mahal and Drew McIntyre was a waste. It was quick, at least, but it was a waste. Charlotte Flair, now a 12-time women's champion. It's only a matter of months before we'll get number 13, 14, and 15. On her way to number 17. She'll get to 17 before John Cena ever does. I think Ric Flair has said he wants his daughter to be the one to break his record. So we know it's going to be Charlotte heading, you know, to number 17 and being the one to break her father's record. The best thing I can say about that, no more Nikki A.S.H. as the Raw Women's Champion. Nikki A.S.H., that character, they had to get that belt off of her. They did. I wish it was on Rhea. They obviously went with Charlotte because they love her. And, I mean, nobody is surprised by the outcome of that match. She was the star of the match. She was out there busting out corkscrew moonsaults off the top rope like a babyface. She got the biggest reaction of any of the women in that match. Nikki A.S.H. got booed out of the building. I heard from people who were there. They said she got booed out of the building. Edge and Seth Rollins had the match of the night at SummerSlam. Started very slow, but it built, and it turned into an excellent match. So kudos to both men. They went out there and stole the show. Edge got the win, as I figured he would. One of the part-time legends was going to get a win on this show, at least one of them, and it was Edge. I figured it would be Edge, and it was Edge. Goldberg, thankfully, did not, but my God, Goldberg and Bobby Lashley for the WWE Championship was atrocious. It was a terrible, terrible match. It went 7 minutes. It was 7 minutes of crap. This would have been bad if it was condensed into 2.5, but at least it would have been shorter. They didn't do a straight, dominant Lashley pinfall win. They did basically an injury finish. They did a ref stoppage because Goldberg couldn't stand up. He tried to stand up. He had a bum knee. He fell down. The referee called the match off. There were some very sloppy spots in this match, including one where Lashley almost landed on his head and his shoulder on a throw off the top rope. It's just everything about this. I was holding my breath hoping neither of them. I don't want to see Goldberg get hurt either. Just because I don't like him in these matches doesn't mean I want to see the guy get fucking hurt. I was holding my breath hoping that nobody would you know, break their neck in this match and they can come out unscathed. That's kind of how I feel every time now I see Bill Goldberg in the ring, which is why Bill Goldberg should not be in the ring. Certainly not in matches like this. There was a time and a place where Goldberg was this big, strong guy who could hang with the other big, strong guys on the roster. This is the man who years ago, 20 years ago, jackhammered the Giant. One of the most impressive feats of strength I've ever seen in a wrestling match. Visually, watching him hold up the Giant in a jackhammer. Or Reese from The Flock, or any of those guys. That was 20 plus years ago. When you put Goldberg in the ring with big guys now, like a Bobby Lashley, who's just a fucking monster physically, or The Undertaker in Saudi Arabia, or anyone like that, I hold my breath and look away each time because I just know it's not going to end well, yet they continue to put him in situations like this. The match with Dolph Ziggler a few years ago was the perfect use of Goldberg. You put him in there with a smaller guy who can bump around for him, you keep it short, you make him look like this just complete monster, and he walks off. But they continue to put him in situations where not only does he look bad, and it exposes him badly, but you're really running a great risk putting anybody in the ring with him at this point. He is a liability in that ring. But the worst part about this is the angle they shot after, which was Lashley taking a chair to his leg, and then Sundberg running into the ring, jumping on Lashley's back. Lashley puts this kid, this 15-year-old kid, Goldberg's son, in the Hurt Lock and puts him out, which I thought was pretty cool. But what it tells me is that they're probably going to be doing another match between Goldberg and Lashley. Now, we're going to wait until Monday night. We're going to wait until tomorrow night on Raw. We're going to see. Because one of you ran an idea by me on the stream last night. Forgot who it was who sent in that super chat, but they suggested that maybe the play here is not to get Goldberg back in the ring with Lashley, but the play is to have Goldberg, in trying to get revenge for what he did to his son, show up on Raw Monday night and take out Lashley, whether it's with a spear or however he does it. And that paves the way for Big E to then cash in his money in the bank for the WWE Championship. And they don't do a second match between Goldberg and Bobby Lashley. I would much prefer that idea to putting these two back in the ring, especially after what we saw last night. So I will wait until Monday night and see which direction they go in. But one thing it does not change is how terrible this was, and my opinion that Goldberg does not have any business being in the ring anymore. This was awful. Roman Reigns and John Cena was the main event on this show. And it was very dull. Early on, it was very boring, very slow. It didn't help that it was almost midnight. I'm sure there were more than a few people in that stadium who were getting very restless at that point. Although they were in Vegas, it wasn't midnight Vegas time. It was midnight Eastern time. But then it started to finally, you know, pick. This is the problem when you have these long matches. This went almost 25 minutes. When you know you're setting up for a long match and it's that late in the night after such a long, there are 10 matches on this card. 11, actually, I guess if you add the Big E match on the kickoff. But it did finally start to get good. And what they ended up doing was having a very good match. The question coming in, what is John Cena going to look like? Can he go in there and have another very good or a classic singles match? A long 20 or 25 minute match when he has not had a proper wrestling match in 2.5 years. And has not had a proper singles match in even longer than that. Closer to 3 years, possibly. That's a very long time. It's a very long layoff for John Cena. He went in there last night and he had a very good match with Roman Reigns that Roman won clean. He finally, in the end, hit the spear and got the win, as he should have. Roman Reigns retains the Universal Championship, but they did not want to send the crowd home on a sour note. And so as Roman is celebrating, we hear Brock Lesnar's theme music and the stadium comes unglued. Out comes Brock in his street clothes looking like a fucking Viking. Like those pictures we saw of him on social media a few weeks ago when he was with the butcher. He was cutting meat. Out comes Brock. He's got the ponytail. He's got the beard. It was a different look than we're used to seeing for Brock on television. He actually changed it up. And he came down to the ring. He got into the ring to confront Roman Reigns. Roman backed out. Paul Heyman throughout this whole thing was practically in tears. He didn't know what to do. Somebody made the analogy on the post show last night when we were hanging out on YouTube. It was something like Heyman was in the situation where his wife had showed up or something when he was hanging out with his girlfriend or something like that. That's exactly what it was. I thought that was a great analogy. But they backed away, and that's how the show went off the air. Which, this seemingly kills any likelihood of a Brock Lesnar-Bobby Lashley match for the foreseeable future. Maybe they're getting Lesnar and Reigns out of the way now, because the tentative plan for a double main event next year at WrestleMania in Dallas is to try to do Rock and Roman, but also do Lesnar against Lashley at Mania. If they could keep the WWE title on Bobby Lashley until then, maybe they would do Lesnar and Lashley, with Lashley as the heel and Lesnar as the face for the championship at WrestleMania next year. Could be the plan. The problem with that is you are once again, as they do every year with WrestleMania, you are once again making it all about your part-time crew. There has to be an end to that at some point. They've got to have enough faith in their own stars and talent to get behind them and put them in those, you know, those big main events. But it could be that they're setting up for that. I don't know. But clearly, we're not really going to be getting anything towards Lesnar and Lashley for the foreseeable future. When they went off the air, he gave John Cena a few German suplexes, Suplex City, and he left him laying with an F5. Just like old times, Brock Lesnar left John Cena laying at SummerSlam with some Germans and an F5. So now the tease is for Brock Lesnar against Roman Reigns, and I like it. I know some people are turned off by this because we've seen Lesnar and Roman so many times before. The fact that the tables are turned now, you know, where does the allegiance of Paul Heyman lie? Right now, Paul Heyman is not with Brock Lesnar. Paul Heyman is with Roman Reigns. So is he going to try to represent both of them? Is he going to turn on Roman Reigns and go back to Brock? Because I still feel like Heyman and Lesnar, you can't, like, they go together so well. I don't like the idea of them not being together, but Brock having to do his own, you know, talking for him and not having Heyman with him. But I like this dynamic, though, of not knowing where Heyman is going to go and having Brock as the babyface destroyer and Roman as the heel destroyer. It's just different enough for me to get excited about it and be interested in seeing where they take this. Of course, this is WWE that we're talking about. So they could easily fuck this whole thing up. I have no faith creatively in them handling these situations. I have more faith, like NXT, I have good faith in Triple H when it comes to stuff like this. AEW, I have some pretty good faith with their big stories. You know, Adam Page aside, if we assume that that was out of their control. Creatively, though, WWE, it's a crapshoot. when it comes to this kind of stuff. But I am excited about the possibilities of where they could take this. After the show, well, actually during the show, they made the announcement, they put the press release out while the show was still on, that they're going to be returning to Allegiant Stadium for Money in the Bank next year, July 4th weekend. They did not say whether it would be that Saturday or Sunday. That is going to be the first time that Money in the Bank will be a stadium show. And they also announced that Sweet Saudi Money 6 is coming in October. They didn't give a date, but October 21st is the rumored date. You know, that could be where we get Goldberg and Lashley again. That could be where we get Lesnar and Reigns. Maybe they don't do it at Extreme Rules next month. Maybe they save it for Saudi Arabia. Or they do the rematch in Saudi Arabia. After doing the first one in September, they do the rematch in October. It's the same thing they did with Seth Rollins and The Fiend. They put them together at Hell in a Cell and they did the rematch in Saudi Arabia, and that's where The Fiend won the Universal title. Maybe they're going to do the same thing with Lesnar and Reigns. They're going to match them up twice. They'll get a Saudi match out of it. I mean, look, it's not completely surprising that Brock Lesnar left the company in April of last year, or March, whichever month WrestleMania was. And now that he's back, they're heading back to Saudi Arabia in October. They've not had a single Saudi show since Brock left because of the pandemic. And now Brock is back just in time for that big Saudi payday. I don't think that is a coincidence. We got some more shout-outs here to wrap up from all of our PayPal supporters. Mean Matt Forbush dropping some love this week. The Wichita Workhorse, Clayton Nettleton. The 90s Vampire, Eddie Valens. Dark Sky, Dixon Krasinski. Kingmaker, Christos Kalansis. Jarmar, Ninetail, Demon Fox Richardson. Michael Maximum Pain, Palkowski, the Pastor of Pain. Damian Yule. Road Rage, Russell Elton. First time donator, so welcome to Russell. Darren Silly Goose Lysett. Silly Goose, if you are in the Facebook group, you know what that is in reference to. I'll give you the quick story here. I get a lot of alerts on a daily basis at this point, because Facebook is ridiculous. Various violations. And when I say like group violations, it's language that people use, but it's not necessarily the stuff that you would expect, which, you know, unfortunately there is some of that. But some of this stuff is just so innocuous and so ridiculous that if you use the word dumb in a post, you could get auto-flagged by the Facebook system as someone who is bullying or harassing. So, like, you could be talking about an idea. You could be talking about a television show. You could be talking about an inanimate object. It does not differentiate between any of that. But this is the dumbest example yet that I have seen. This right here, it tells you exactly why the system on Facebook is completely broken. There was a post that Darren made where he referred, it was in response to Brian Bird in the Facebook group, and he used the expression and referred to him as a silly goose over something that he had said. Well, I guess we know what kind of bird Brian Bird is now. He called him a silly goose. He got flagged. I got the alert for bullying and harassment. And what it does is all these violations put the group at jeopardy, not for termination, but for post approval on every single post for 30 days, where anybody who makes a post, it would first have to be approved by myself or a mod before it would actually post to the group. So that's what it does in terms of putting various Facebook groups at risk. But think about the idea that what might actually trigger that is the fact that somebody called another person a silly goose. That might be the nicest thing that anybody has said about somebody else on Facebook when you see some of the shit that people say to each other on Facebook. And that's what got flagged. So the system is completely broken. And before you say, well, it's an automated system, it is. But the follow-up update to that story is that it was appealed. Darren appealed it. It had to be reviewed then by a human. It was reviewed and it was upheld. So this was not just a case of an algorithm picking up on something that it shouldn't have. You know, stuff like that happens on YouTube, for example, and then if you appeal it, YouTube will review it, and more often than not, they'll overturn it because they realize that this is stupid. Someone had to actually look at that comment and say, yep, That looks like bullying and harassment to me. What a fucking stupid website. What a dumb site. But we got a PayPal nickname out of it for Darren. So he is now the Silly Goose here on the show. Sean Grand Slam Green. Check out his friend's gaming channel on YouTube called RVD Worldwide, where he plays games like Fortnite, providing tips and tricks while completing different quests and obtaining many of the popular skins that the game offers. RVD Worldwide on YouTube. Check him out. And last but not least here, Philip and his wife run a YouTube channel called My Slotty Obsession, and they want to thank everybody who has taken a moment to visit their page. They post videos of their high-limit slot play at casinos all throughout the country. And these are very quick hits, almost like little video bites for you to go ahead and view on their channel. Just type in My Slotty Obsession into the search bar on YouTube, like and subscribe. And thank you for everybody who has taken a moment to check out their content. NXT TakeOver 36 is live tonight from the COVID Coliseum in Orlando. Sucks that it's happening there and not in a bigger building with more people. But the card looks great. It was reported in this week's Observer that the relationship between WWE and Full Sail University, which was almost 10 years strong, is now officially over. I blame the pandemic for this, because were it not for COVID and the need to relocate, I don't believe this would be happening. In fact, 2 years ago, they expanded their partnership. But that partnership now appears to be over, and it's a damn shame. You know, I'm going to miss that building. The fans were starting to grate on my nerves, but there were a lot of great matches and moments that I remember from that building, you know, from NXT over the years, debuts. It wasn't much, like physically, it wasn't much bigger than the CWC, but they could fit between, you know, 400 and 500 people in there. And it just had its own unique personality. Maybe they can go back there and do a homecoming show one day. But the reason why NXT is taping a bunch of shows in advance coming out of TakeOver tonight is to make upgrades to the Performance Center in preparation for a permanent move there. There has been talks of finally taking down the plexiglass barriers, which I hope they do. I said there was one study in the news this week that showed that plexiglass dividers, or at least some types of them, might actually make things worse because it impedes airflow and it could actually increase COVID infection. They don't know. They're all figuring this stuff out as they go along. But you know what? Take them down. They're an eyesore. I don't think they're needed anymore. I don't really think they accomplish much anyway. Take them down. They also think that the shows look too dark. And so they're going to be lighting this show up like a Christmas tree, it sounds like, going forward with brighter, more colorful lights. And the idea is said to be something closer to what NXT was at the start, is what they're going for, with younger students, less established veterans featured on the show, less of them, less of the indie stars. I can't imagine USA Network being very happy about this. This is not what they paid for. And honestly, I think the best thing that could happen, if they're making wholesale changes here to NXT, which obviously they are, I think the best thing that could happen to NXT is for USA Network, when the deal is up, whenever that may be, to pass on renewing. And just make NXT an hour again on Peacock. Just go all the way with it and start from scratch. Because everything with NXT was fine until they expanded it to 2 hours and they moved it to USA Network. So if they're going to be making all these changes, then just go back to the way it used to be and just blow it up and start over. Probably be the best thing they could possibly do. There was no Triple H conference call this week. They usually have a media call with Triple H days before each TakeOver show. And there was none this week. Supposedly he was too busy. I'm sure he is a very busy guy, but he always makes time for these media calls. Not this week. Because he knows he can't answer any of the questions honestly that people are going to have for him. Whether it relates to Vince McMahon, whether it relates to the recent talent cuts that supposedly he wasn't even consulted about. Whether it's about Adam Cole's status or Pete Dunne's status. So he just decided to make himself scarce and not be available for a media call. Can't talk, too busy. There's nothing he can say with any degree of honesty that won't get him in hot water. So better to just hide. On the card tonight, Ridge Holland is going to be taking on Trey Baxter. On the pre-show, should be an easy win for Holland. Walter defends his NXT United Kingdom Championship against Ilya Dragunov. Walter has been the United Kingdom Champion for nearly 870 days. He won the title at TakeOver New York in April of 2019. I was at that show at the Barclays Center for the beginning of his reign. A reign that I believe comes to an end tonight. I think Dragunov is going to walk out of there with the United Kingdom Championship. He got a hard-fought win over Roderick Strong on Tuesday that did not come without taking some damage. He got his face busted open. He was bleeding everywhere. I think he wins the title, and I think Walter begins making more appearances on the main NXT show. Now, that does not mean that he has to move to the United States. I know he has said he does not want to move here. I can't say I blame him for not wanting to move to Florida right now. I think he's got the right idea, but he doesn't have to be on the show every single week. They made it work with Brock Lesnar. They could do the same with Walter, who eventually, I think, challenges Samoa Joe or whoever it may be, but, you know, hopefully Samoa Joe for the NXT Championship, and he wins it, and he starts a whole new reign in NXT proper. He has a reign in NXT UK that will never be matched. He can move on to NXT and begin a brand new reign. He could be the new final boss on NXT. So I'm picking Dragunov for the win. LA Knight defends his $1 million championship against Cameron Grimes. If Grimes loses, Ted DiBiase must become LA Knight's new butler. Knight paid off Josh Briggs to the tune of $10,000 on Tuesday to take out Cameron Grimes. Grimes beat him. Knight left him laying when it was over, though, and he punched Ted DiBiase in the face. He was out there doing commentary. And then later on in the back, with DiBiase, Grimes finally proclaimed that he is no longer a butler, and he is going to win the $1 million championship for the both of them and go to the moon. Part of me hates seeing DiBiase as any kind of babyface, because the $1 million man should not be a babyface. And I kind of want to find out that he and Knight have been pulling one over on Grimes this entire time and have been working together. But then we don't get the payoff that we need. We don't get the payoff that we deserve. And I think we're going to get it here. I think we're going to get a title change. Cameron Grimes is my pick to win. It is the right payoff to this story. Raquel Gonzalez defends the NXT Women's Championship against Dakota Kai. One thing to keep in mind here, Dakota Kai was brought up for a match on Main Event recently and lost to Aaliyah. But she was brought up, not Raquel Gonzalez. I think that Raquel is going to retain the title. Were it not for that, I think I might have gone with Dakota with the idea that she debuts a new bodyguard to help her replace Raquel and help her beat Raquel for the championship. And then Raquel can go on to feud with whoever that person is before ultimately, you know, getting her rematch for the title. But I don't think Kai is long for NXT. That's not the sense that I get. I still wish they would have gone with Dakota as the underdog babyface here and Raquel as the heel. I just think it just feels backwards to me. But I think Raquel retains her championship. We've got Adam Cole against Kyle O'Reilly. 2 out of 3 falls, with the first fall being a straight match, the second fall being a street fight. And if necessary, the third and deciding fall will be contested inside a steel cage. Do they even have room to raise that cage in that building? It's not that big of a building. I guess the ceilings, though, are fairly tall at the CWC. This should be a Kyle O'Reilly win. I'm picking him to win. Whether Cole stays or leaves is irrelevant, I think, to the finish of this match. I would not read too much into the finish. If Adam Cole loses, that does not mean that he is leaving NXT to go to the main roster. It does not, even though it's probably where he would go. I don't think him losing, though, means he's leaving the company and going to AEW necessarily. Because this whole feud, I think, has been building to this moment for Kyle. So I really don't think Adam Cole's status changes a thing. I think Kyle should win this. I think he wins the first fall. I think Cole wins the second fall, and I think Kyle wins it in the cage. And then the question becomes, what is next for Adam Cole? That is the million-dollar question. What will his decision be? The writers on Raw and SmackDown have reportedly been told to begin coming up with ideas for it. So they're hoping that he will stick around, and they're already trying to come up with some creative pitches for him. If you ask me, what do I think he's going to do? It's very different than what I wishes he would do. I think he's going to stay. But I want him to leave. I want him to leave and go to AEW. I just think AEW would be a good fit for him. I think AEW would be a better fit for him than it would be for Bray Wyatt. There are rumors that Bray Wyatt is AEW bound. I think that came from Meltzer. That's not confirmed. He says, you know, there's no pen to paper yet, but his belief is that Bray Wyatt is on his way to All Elite Wrestling. If they had two options and can only pick one of who may be available if Adam Cole was to become a free agent, I would go with Adam Cole over Bray Wyatt in terms of going to AEW. If I had a choice between those two, I just think it would be the right place for him to be. He was very adamant on his Twitch stream the other night, or the other day, that under no circumstances will he give up his streams, will he not be streaming. Because others on the main roster are supposedly not allowed to stream on Twitch. I thought Zelina Vega was back on Twitch. But I could be wrong. I don't keep tabs on all of their twitching in that company. So if they want him to stay, they're going to have to make an exception for him. I mean, how are you going to make an exception for one and not for everybody else? I mean, that's the problem when you make exceptions, right? I mean, it's like, that's the whole point. You make an exception for one. Hey, that's not fair. What about me? I don't know how they're going to handle that. My only advice, you know, not that he cares, but my only advice for him would be run. Run, Adam, run. Run as fast as your feet will carry you. Run like you have never run before. And Karrion Kross defends the NXT Championship. Boy, you know, if only Adam Cole had the size of a Karrion Kross, he would be the champion right now. Karrion Kross defends the NXT title against Samoa Joe, back at the ring for the first time since an 8-man tag on Monday Night Raw on February 10th of 2020. Before concussion issues took him out of the game, Joe's best days physically are behind him. I think that's a fair statement to make, even if you are a Samoa Joe fan and you want to see him back, as I do. If you think he's got one last run or a world title run in him, as I do, if they wanted to do that, I would love to see it. But physically, his best days are behind him, and they have been for many years. But he is still a major player. And someone who could have big matches with other names like Pete Dunne and Walter. Kross is on Monday Night Raw now. There is no need for him to carry around that NXT championship any longer. The minute he lost to Jeff Hardy, and later on he lost to Keith Lee, the argument went out the window that you should not beat him because, oh, he's undefeated. In NXT, he's undefeated. He should just relinquish the title like Asuka did when she got called up. Well, guess what? You no longer have that problem because he lost and he's going to lose again here. I predict Samoa Joe will be your new NXT champion. Join me live later on tonight for your second sound off of the day. I'm going to be live on YouTube after NXT TakeOver with my full review and, of course, your messages and questions about whatever in this ridiculously busy week, very newsworthy week of pro wrestling. I'm glad that you chose me for your coverage, and hopefully you will continue to do so tonight. Some other thoughts, though, from Tuesday's episode of NXT that didn't fit into these predictions here. There was a confrontation out in the parking lot with Hit Row and Legado del Fantasma that was shot, I thought, really cool, cinematic style. I thought it worked. Top Dollar tried to recreate the Kevin Nash, Rey Mysterio lawn dart spot from Nitro, although not nearly as good. But Swerve Scott got his grill back. I hope he washes it thoroughly with soap and water before he puts it back in his mouth. Indy Hartwell got down on one knee and proposed to Dexter Lumis after their mixed tag win over Robert Stone and Jesse Kamea, and he accepted. He pulled off his black glove, and she put a ring on his finger, and the ring had this weird eyeball on it, and wedding bells will be ringing soon. If there's anything that you, as a promoter, can rely on to try to pop a rating, it is a wrestling wedding. And so we will have a wrestling wedding very soon on NXT. And Carmelo Hayes beat Duke Hudson in the breakout tournament to move to the finals against Odyssey Jones. The action has been good. Nothing wrong with a lot of the matches that we've seen. They're just very, very dull. This whole tournament has been very, very dull. It's been a very big disappointment. There's just nothing exciting about it. I did pick Carmelo Hayes to win at the start of all this. I don't have a good feeling about that now that I know who he's going to be up against. I think Odyssey Jones is someone I can see Triple H putting the title on next year and building the brand around, at least until Vince McMahon calls him up and steals him away. They're looking for big guys who can be attractions, and he fits that bill to a T. New Japan continues to struggle with the COVID bug. Boy, they have been bit like no other company has been bit by this whole situation. Eight wrestlers were pulled. Eight! From Monday's Summer Struggle show at Corken Hall, including IWGP champion Shingo Takagi, who came down with a fever. The other names were Tetsuya Naito, Evil, Sonata, Bushi, Yujiro, Ghetto, and Dick Togo, who were scheduled to participate in the Super Junior Tag League. Instead, they had to forfeit their match. Seven wrestlers were pulled the next day from the show due to COVID concerns, and in the case of Shingo and Bushi, they both tested positive for the virus. And they are said to be doing better. Their fevers have gone down. They are still isolating, which just wreaks havoc on things, especially when one of them is your world champion. That's the bad news. The good news is that Kota Ibushi is on the mend, and he is on his way back very soon. He has been out of action since July 2nd, battling aspiration pneumonia that is said to be unrelated to COVID, but was very serious situation there. Tanahashi, after beating Lance Archer in LA last weekend to win the IWGP United States title, called out Ibushi, who responded this week with a video, accepting Tanahashi's challenge to a match at their Wrestle Grand Slam show on September 4th, which is the day before All Out in Chicago. So there is no chance of Tanahashi being there to defend against Jon Moxley, which they had seemed to be teasing a little bit. I guess, you know, they'll just have to wait for another day. Plus, they have the start of the G1 coming up next month. Tanahashi has already promised a rematch first to Lance Archer, assuming that he gets past Ibushi on September 4th. All this, Forbidden Door stuff, and we've got Bryan Danielson yet to make his AEW debut, and nobody is talking about Okada. Nobody's talking about Okada. Where's he at? He's laying low. Imagine the matches that he'll have with some of these guys when they bust that door open even wider. That's what I'm waiting for. Give me Okada against any of these guys. Punk, Bryan, any of them. Now, some other miscellaneous notes. Per WrestleVotes on Twitter, this is what they posted. With the success of MLB's Field of Dreams game last week, WWE has began very initial discussions about doing a few off-site events in 2022. Some ideas discussed within Creative include Raw on the Roof, Hammerstein Ballroom, and more direct festival shows like Rolling Loud. The Rolling Loud thing I thought was a cool thing to try. In execution, though, I didn't think it really came across well at all because the people there just didn't seem to care. They didn't know what the hell was going on, and they weren't reacting to anything. So, I mean, it's cool to see this large crowd of, 50,000 people out there, but they didn't seem to give two shits about the matches they were seeing. Raw on the Roof, I guess, is pretty self-explanatory. I don't know if that would be on the roof of Titan Tower, or I'm not quite sure what roof it would be on. I know one thing, though. Raw on the Roof will not be any better than Raw on the Ground. Raw is in the ground these days. I don't really give a shit where they do Raw. I would just hope that one day we might actually get a good show. Wouldn't that be special? You could do Raw in the basement of someone's fucking house for all I care, as long as it is a good show. The location does not matter. Hammerstein, though, is interesting. to do some kind of a special show, like maybe not Raw, but some kind of special show at Hammerstein, I think. I always wondered why they never tried doing an NXT show at Hammerstein. At this rate, I think AEW might beat them to the punch. We might get an AEW Dynamite or a Rampage at Hammerstein before we get NXT. If I'm Tony Khan, I'm trying to make that happen. You know, they're making their New York City debut next month. And they're going to get 17,000 people in Arthur Ashe Stadium, at least, unless they open up more sections, which is possible. But I think after that, you know, maybe that ends up being kind of their home building, but I'm trying to book some stuff at the Hammerstein Ballroom in front of, you know, a rabid 2,500. I just think it would make for a cool atmosphere for one of their TV shows. Not a pay-per-view, but you want to do a Dynamite or a Rampage at Hammerstein? The only thing is, you know, I've heard that that building is not the best building to shoot TV. That's where Raw was many years ago, in that same building up on the Grand Ballroom on the top floor. So it might not be the easiest location, and, you know, wrestlers have talked about how there was one bathroom or one shower, and it kind of sucked. But I think even as a one-off, AEW at Hammerstein, if WWE isn't going to run there, if I'm Tony Khan, I'm trying to get that building nailed down. I think that would be a lot of fun. Dark Side of the Ring Season 3 returns on September 16th on Vice TV with the second half of the third season. 7 new episodes are coming up, covering the plane ride from hell, Chris Kanyon, Johnny Canine, Luna Vachon, FMW, which is going to have interviews with Terry Funk and Atsushi Onita, XPW, and the steroid trials of Vince McMahon and George Zahorian, that's the episode that they interviewed Jerry McDevitt. WWE lawyer Jerry McDevitt, before he sat down to be interviewed. I will, of course, be reviewing each episode on YouTube again, as I did for the first half of the season. And finally here, before we jump into the history stuff, many months ago, when the transition began from the WWE Network to Peacock, we were told that the plan, the goal, the timeline, was to have all of the current network content up on Peacock by SummerSlam. That was the timeline they set for themselves. And to their credit, because, you know, when Peacock screws up, obviously I vent about that, but I'm fair. And when they do something right, or there's a reason to praise them or give them credit, I will do so. And to their credit, even though I still don't like how hard it is to find a lot of things on there, And I really miss features they had on like the big pay-per-views and stuff, like chapter markers during the shows. That's just not built into the Peacock platform. That's just something that they aren't able to do right now. I will give the devil its due. Here we are in the middle of SummerSlam weekend, and it looks like they've gotten pretty much everything up that was on the network before. I think save for a few things that, you know, most people probably wouldn't even be looking for. A few random things here and there. They pretty much have everything up that was there previously. That includes every episode of Raw, SmackDown, ECW, all the pay-per-views, Saturday Night's Main Event, all the primetime wrestling stuff that had been up before, which is not all of the primetime wrestling episodes, but everything that was up before I think is now up on there. All the episodes of Superstars from 1992 that was up before, all the way through mid-94. Early Wrestling Challenge, all the Coliseum videos, it's all up. And so now the question turns to how proactive are the Peacock folks going to be at adding more of the old content? Because now they have to pick up the slack, right? Everything that was on the network before is back, but now going forward, what about all the stuff that isn't there? That even previously had not been uploaded. How quickly are they going to be able to get that, or how quickly are they going to want to or care to get that old stuff up? Because previously, whenever the network would have a classic drop of content, let's use Superstars as an example. Usually they would upload 20 episodes at once. Now with Peacock, they usually add about 8. So they're moving a lot slower than the WWE Network did before. The classic stuff for me, everyone is different. For me, that really is the main reason that I subscribe outside of the pay-per-views, which I have to watch because I have to cover this stuff for the podcast. Outside of that, the only reason I really subscribe to the network is for the classic stuff. And I like stuff like the Broken Skull Sessions, and they have some good documentaries, but the classic stuff is really what appeals to me the most. And I know I'm probably not the only one, but I also know that I might be in the minority here. And the majority of the people who pay for Peacock for the network are probably doing it for the pay-per-views and for the current stuff. Because maybe they're a newer fan, they're a younger fan, they don't really care about the old stuff. But good on Peacock for hitting their goal.
History has been made here!
This week, in wrestling history, we go back 61 years ago this week, on August 16th, 1960. Vern Gagne awarded himself the AWA Heavyweight Championship, starting his first of 10 reigns with that title, including a 7-year reign that lasted from 1968 to 1975. Pat O'Connor, who was then the NWA World's Heavyweight Champion, was named the first AWA champion after the organization split away from the NWA. Even though he never wrestled a match for them until many years later, they awarded him the title and made him the champion. What happened is that Gagne had been lobbying for an NWA title match against O'Connor. And when they weren't receptive to that idea, and he realized that that just wasn't going to happen, he and Wally Carbo, who was the co-founder of the AWA with him, formed the AWA. They recognized O'Connor as the first AWA champion, and they gave him 90 days to defend the title against Vern. The NWA ignored that challenge, and so O'Connor was stripped of the championship, and it was awarded to Gagne. On that same day, 31 years ago, August 16th, 1990, Pat O'Connor passed away, 6 days shy of his 66th birthday from cancer. 28 years ago this week, on August 18th, 1993, at the Ocean Center in Daytona Beach, Florida, an incident that will live on forever in wrestling infamy, and the single funniest botch that I have ever seen on a wrestling show, the ill-fated debut of the Shockmaster at WCW's Clash of the Champions. They had 8,900 fans in the building, one of their biggest crowds of the year, but it's kind of tainted when you realize that only 2,400 of them actually paid to get in. When Ric Flair returned to WCW earlier that year, per his WWE release, which Vince McMahon gave to him, they had a gentleman's agreement, a handshake agreement, that if Vince McMahon ever phased Flair down the card and he wasn't being a featured performer in top, you know, matches and main events anymore, and if he wanted to go back to WCW, that Vince McMahon would let him walk. And to his credit, Vince McMahon did let Flair go. But he had a non-compete in that he wasn't allowed to wrestle right away. So instead, he began hosting a talk show segment on television called A Flair for the Gold. And on this edition of A Flair for the Gold, the plan was that he would help Sting and Davey Boy Smith, the British Bulldog, reveal their mystery partner for the upcoming War Games match at Fall Brawl against Sid Vicious, Vader, and Harlem Heat. Fred Ottman was brought in for the role. He was Tugboat and then later Typhoon in WWE. Dusty Rhodes brought him in. He and Dusty were brothers-in-law. So Ottman is Cody's uncle, which is why he would call him Uncle Fred. Dusty's original plan for the Shockmaster was just to have another babyface to plug in on the babyface side for the War Games match. The costume was not the original costume. What he wore during this segment with the Stormtrooper helmet covered in glitter was something that they pieced together to send him out there in. With the original outfit that was made, he looked more like a superhero. He had gold lightning bolts going down each of his legs. He had, you know, a gold attire, a lucha-style mask with a lightning bolt going through the face and his hair coming out of the top of the mask. I have no idea why they didn't just send him out in that. He told WWE.com that when they put the helmet on his head, the glitter was coming through the eye holes and into his eyes. So they got a pair of dark pantyhose, they cut two pieces, they glued them, and they put them over the eye holes so that the glitter wouldn't come into his eyes. So the plan was that when they introduced him, he would step through the wall, which was not gimmicked. They told him, you're going to have to really hit this thing hard to bust through. Well, after they had already rehearsed it earlier and everything went well, Dusty said that sabotage, he believes, came into play. Somebody went and put down a 2x4 board on the floor that old Uncle Fred couldn't see. So, if you watch the segment back, Sting says, our mystery partner is going to shock the world because he is none other than the Shock Master! And he comes busting through the top part of the wall and he trips over the board that he did not see in this helmet. And he tumbles forward, face first, and his helmet goes flying off his head. Dusty, he was in the back watching all this, and Dusty said, he said his head came rolling across the floor like Game of Thrones, and the only thing funnier is if he had tried to put it on backwards. Dusty is in the back crying with laughter. He said he almost passed out. He was laughing so hard. He couldn't even speak. And when he fell, you could hear someone say, I told you. Ric Flair, you can hear him go, oh God. Booker T can be heard asking, who is this motherfucker? Davey Boy says, he fell flat on his arse. He fell flat on his fucking arse. Shockmaster scrambles to try to put the helmet back on his head because he knows that Ole Anderson is in the back about to start cutting a promo over the PA system. Since they couldn't mic the helmet up, Ole was the one who was going to do the promo for him. He would sort of stand there and just pretend that the voice was coming from him, even though you could clearly tell it wasn't. So they distorted his voice. It looked completely ridiculous. Dusty used to tell the story, you know, when Cody was a young kid at the time, he was at home watching the show with his cousins and nephews, like a whole bunch of little kids. And he watches the helmet roll across the floor and he looks at the Shockmaster on the screen and he says, I think that was Uncle Fred. Because it was Uncle Fred. They tried to make the best of a bad situation after this. They turned his character into this lovable klutz wearing a white shirt and jeans and a construction helmet. As the aforementioned Uncle Fred, they actually started calling him Uncle Fred on TV. And he didn't leave right away. I mean, he stuck around into the beginning of 94 before leaving the company. But old Uncle Fred has a good attitude about the whole thing. He told Pro Wrestling Stories many years ago. I'd rather be happy than miserable. Mean people suck. They're horrible. You can die any day. You can walk off a curb. You can get hit by a car. And you would be gone. My last minute of the day is not going to be me upset or mean or unhappy. I got two arms, two legs, I'm breathing, I've been around many people. If you think you have a horrible life, maybe you should go to a burn unit in a hospital or a kids' cancer unit and see what they have to deal with in their life. Or people coming back from being overseas in battles and missing legs and arms and PTSD and all kinds of issues going on. Everybody's got problems, everybody has had a Shockmaster moment, stuff happens. The best thing, and I tell everybody all the time, you take whatever negative there may be and turn it into a positive. He says, the Shockmaster gimmick has been very good to me. Millions of views on YouTube. They came out with the action figure that premiered at the 2016 San Diego Comic-Con. The people there were buying them left and right. And he's right. The Shockmaster has become quite the fan favorite in recent years. This moment, when I watch it back, still makes me laugh out loud. Every single time. Actually, you know what's even funnier if you could find it? I had watched this on YouTube a few years ago. I think it was on, I don't remember if it was back in the Opie and Anthony days. If it might have been on Opie and Anthony or I think Jim Norton was there. And anyway, they were talking about the Shockmaster. I don't even know how it came up. But they were talking about the Shockmaster and describing the story. And maybe they were playing the clip for one of the hosts. But the way they were reacting to it and laughing. I want to say Patrice O'Neill may have been part of this segment, but I don't remember exactly. listening to them reacting to the Shockmaster is even funnier than watching the Shockmaster segment itself. I was busting a gut laughing at this segment. So the Shockmaster has given a lot of people a lot of joy and a lot of laughs over the years, including Jesse Ventura, who was doing commentary that night. He could barely keep it together on commentary after when he said, "What an entrance for the Shockmaster! We're full of spectacular entrances!" And he was laughing as he was saying it. He was corpsing. Send for the man. The body was corpsing. I like that, actually. That's a good play on words there. The body was corpsing. Also on this show, it is a footnote compared to this, but the Road Warriors reunited on screen for the first time since Hawk split from the WWF and left Animal in a lurch. They were not on good terms. There was a lot of heat there. But Hawk appeared as the mystery partner for Dustin Rhodes in his match against Rick Rude and the Equalizer, who was fucking terrible. Hawk made a last-minute deal to appear as his partner, and Animal had already made a deal to come in, although not to wrestle because he was still collecting on his Lloyd's of London insurance policy for a back injury. So the two didn't actually reunite in the ring together until, I think it was early 1996, and this was 93. So it was a while yet before the Road Warriors were back as an actual team. But the heat between them was bad enough, even as recently as a few weeks before this show. Animal no-showed another promotions event knowing that Hawk would be there. So them being sort of back together and kind of repairing that bridge shocked a lot of people. No pun intended, of course. 26 years ago this week, on August 20th, 1995, IWA Japan presented its Kawasaki Dream Show before a crowd of more than 28,000 fans at Kawasaki Stadium in Japan, featuring the famous King of the Deathmatch tournament, with Cactus Jack beating Terry Gordy and Shoji Nakamaki in the first two rounds to advance to the finals against Terry Funk, who beat Leatherface and Tiger Jeet Singh to advance to the final match. Mick Foley told Terry Gordy in their match to hit him as hard as he could in the opening minutes, which resulted in a black eye and Foley needing 4 stitches in his head, plus stitches also in his hand and his one good ear after taking a bump off a ladder onto a barbed wire board. In the finals, Cactus pinned Funk in a no-ropes barbed wire exploding time bomb match. Funk suffered serious burns to his arm after it caught on fire from one of the explosions. The ring was supposed to blow up 10 minutes into the match. Funk was down in the middle of the ring by himself as the ring announcer started counting down to zero. And then they had an AEW moment. Long before Kenny Omega and Jon Moxley had their embarrassing finale in their no ropes, barbed wire. Was it no ropes? I don't even remember now if it was no ropes. But they had their barbed wire exploding death match of Revolution earlier this year. Long before that happened, we had this, where 4 little tiny pyro explosions went off in each corner, and it looked laughable. The crowd started booing, but they continued the match for another few minutes to try to get them back into it before Cactus ultimately won the match. 21 years ago this week, on the August 21st, 2000 edition of Raw is War from Lafayette, Louisiana, Lita defeated Stephanie McMahon Helmsley to win the WWE Women's Championship the first time in Raw history that a women's match main evented the show. The Rock was the guest referee. Triple H and Kurt Angle were ringside and got involved. This was during the whole love triangle storyline with Stephanie. Lita got a huge reaction winning the title, and the match did a monster 7.7 overrun rating. 6 years ago this week, on August 22nd, 2015, NXT presented its first takeover show outside Full Sail University with over 15,000 fans in attendance, myself included, at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn. Up to that point, the largest crowd ever for an NXT event in a match that was taped for TV. Emma won a fatal four-way over Charlotte Flair, Becky Lynch, and Dana Brooke, pinning Becky in a finish that was botched. Emma did her Emma sandwich in the corner, and she legitimately knocked Becky silly. And she was supposed to kick out when Emma went for the pin, but she didn't, and then the referee counted three. Anyway, when he did so, then Becky got a shoulder up, but it was too late. You could see Drake Wirtz, you know, as he was raising Emma's hand after the match was over, mouthing the words, "Be happy, you won. Be happy for the camera." Live in the building, they continued with their spots anyway, including Charlotte spearing Emma and counting her own pin, which was the original planned finish. All of the women were said to be very upset about what had happened here and the whole finish being screwed up. Jushin Thunder Liger was brought in for a match against Tyler Breeze, which he won. I'm so glad I got to see Liger live. This was a lot of fun. It was his one and only WWE match on American soil. How it came about is that Liger was at a Ring of Honor event in Philadelphia, where NXT happened to be running that same week, and he wanted to go see Finn Balor wrestle. And so he had a New Japan agent reach out to Matt Bloom, who was the head coach at NXT. He replaced Bill Mott, or Bill DeMott. Bill Mott. Sorry to the Bill Mott who might be out there, but he replaced Bill DeMott, did Matt Bloom. Bloom, of course, spent many years working in Japan as Giant Bernard before he came back and started doing the whole Lord Tenzai gimmick. So Bloom got Liger a seat. What was he going to say? No, fuck off? Of course, he got him a seat. Nobody recognized him because he wasn't wearing his mask. A few weeks later, William Regal, Matt Bloom, and Finn Balor called New Japan's office. Maybe it was a three-way conference call. I don't know. But they called the office and they asked for Liger's email address because Liger was freelancing at the time and also working for New Japan, so he wasn't just exclusive to New Japan. They wanted his email, but he doesn't use a computer. So instead, they put him in touch, or they put them in touch with a representative, and that's how the match came to be. Tyler Breeze told Chris Van Vliet, "I had a couple of ideas, and we put it together. The crazy part to me was when I said, maybe I tackle you, and I go and lay on top, then you get me with something, and you go lay on top." He goes, "Me lay on top?" And I said, "Yeah." He goes, "Oh, thank you, thank you." And he shakes my hand. I go, "What do you mean, thank you? This is awesome." He said, "You're letting me do your stuff." "Well, of course, why wouldn't I?" And then I said, "Maybe you grab the selfie stick." And again, he says, "Me grab the selfie stick? Thank you, thank you." And he shakes his hand again. What is happening? This is insane. He is a legend in his own category. He is sitting here thanking me for letting him do whatever he wants to do. The man has no ego whatsoever. Also on this show, William Regal announced the first ever Dusty Rhodes Tag Team Classic. Japanese women's star Kana was shown at ringside next to Ric Flair and Sergeant Slaughter. She would go on to take the name Asuka when she debuted the following month, which made her the first Japanese female acquisition for WWE since Bull Nakano in 1994. Then we had Sasha Banks against Bayley for the NXT Women's Championship, the greatest women's match in WWE history. That is a hill that I am willing to die on, although I don't think I'll have to because I think most people would agree. But if you don't, well, everyone's entitled to be wrong. This is the greatest match in company history with respect to the women. The story coming into the match was great. The match itself was great. The crowd was, I can tell you from being there, the crowd was as into that match as any of the matches on the show that night. And we had that just fantastic moment at the end where Bayley finally won the championship. And of course, they got all the horse women into the ring to do their horse women pose when it was over. Charlotte, Becky, Bayley, Sasha. This was, 6 years ago? I mean, we see now how important those women have become and how featured those women have become in this company. But I loved everything about the match. I loved how vicious Sasha was going after Bayley's injured hand. I loved the spot where she had Bayley in the bank statement. Bayley is trying to reach for the ropes with the hand, but Sasha starts stomping on it. And then Bayley kind of transitions out of it and puts the hold on herself. Place was going nuts for that. Of course, the finish was the reverse Rana off the top, where it looked like Sasha landed on her head, but she was okay. Crazy. Just a crazy match. This match right here to me, it's one of my all-time favorite matches. This match to me is what wrestling should be. Just everything about it, from the story to the match itself and people having that level of buy-in into it. This was so much fun to watch. This is going to be a match that people go back years from now and watch. And there was not going to be anything else on this show. There was not going to be anything, frankly, in the building at all that weekend that was going to top what we saw here in this match. And Finn Balor and Kevin Owens, they tried, and they had a very good match, but Finn Balor beat Kevin Owens in the main event ladder match to retain his NXT championship. Now, there were a bunch of SummerSlam shows. I did not forget about the SummerSlams. I just figured I would lump them all together. There have been a lot of SummerSlams this week in history, as I'm sure there will be for next week's segment. So, let's run through some of them here. This might not be every single one of them, but these are the important ones. 25 years ago this week, on August 18th, 1996, SummerSlam came to the Gund Arena in Cleveland, Ohio. The definition of a two-match show. We had a Bikini Beach blast-off on the free-for-all pre-show, which included T.L. Hopper, the wrestling plumber, jumping in the pool where Jerry Lawler was lounging out to fetch what, at first, appeared to be a giant turd. It looked like somebody took a dump in the pool. That's what they wanted you to believe. But upon further inspection, as T.L. Hopper swam down and picked it up with his bare hand, he found that it was just a baby Ruth, which he began eating. Also on the free-for-all, on the same show where they did this segment, they gave us Stone Cold Steve Austin, your King of the Ring that year, against Yokozuna. Remember the King of the Ring? Austin 316. Everyone said, it's the speech that made him an instant sensation. Yeah, it made him such an instant sensation that he wrestled a two-minute match against Yokozuna on the pre-show. I said, what made Austin was the feud with Bret Hart later that year. That is what got Austin on his path. It was not only the speech at the King of the Ring. The speech without what followed later that year doesn't get Austin anywhere. But this match here only ended when Yokozuna, due to his enormous girth, broke the top rope and fell backwards, and he was pinned by Austin. We had Psycho Sid defeating the British Bulldog in a match originally advertised locally as the Ultimate Warrior taking on the Bulldog. This was before Warrior was suspended and left the company. Sid was brought in to take his place in July, and he ended up parlaying that into a WWF title win just a few months later. Sid was super over during this period. You go back and you watch Sid and hit the reactions to Sid, probably starting around September, but definitely October into November. This guy was just super over. Ahmed Johnson was to have defended his Intercontinental title against Farouk on this show, but he missed the show with a very serious kidney injury that landed him in intensive care and required emergency surgery to stop his kidney from bleeding. This was all because of a brutal kick that Farouk gave him on TV. It was the night that Farouk debuted, when he ran out wearing that ridiculous gladiator costume. He ran out there and he just field kicked him right in the kidney. And he really fucked up Ahmed pretty good. Meanwhile, he wound up having to vacate the championship not long after this. He couldn't come back right away. That's how bad the injury was. Jerry Lawler beat Jake the Snake Roberts in a match that Jake absolutely hated. This was during his born again phase, but he was still very much struggling with his demons. Lawler would mock him on TV for it, and he would tempt him with bottles of booze, and here in this match at the very end, he forced what was supposedly bourbon down Jake's throat, which I think Jake has claimed was real liquor and it burned. Bruce Pritchard and Jerry Lawler both say that it was not actual bourbon. They said that it was iced tea. Mankind beat The Undertaker in the very first Boiler Room Brawl, which I really enjoyed. They started in the boiler room of the arena with the object being to get to the ring first. So you got to go from the boiler room to the ring. Inside the ring, you will retrieve the urn that Paul Bearer was holding. And this was before the days of giant Titantron. So they wheeled these little TVs out into the crowd on TV stands so that the fans could watch along. All of the boiler room stuff was taped the day before. Undertaker suffered a very bad staph infection in his elbow during this match, Foley hurt his back on the ladder spot where Undertaker pulled him backwards and tipped the ladder over that he was standing on, and he fell backwards onto, I think, a bunch of cardboard and beams and other stuff. He messed up his sciatic nerve on that spot. But Mankind would go on to win the match when Paul Bearer betrayed The Undertaker, ending a nearly six-year alliance. And Shawn Michaels retained his WWE Championship against Vader in a main event that was restarted twice, with Vader first winning by countout and then by disqualification. Both times, Jim Cornette said, no, 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 because he knew the title cannot change hands on a countout or a DQ. He wanted a definitive winner. So even though Shawn Michaels technically lost twice here, they restarted the match. Ultimately, Michaels did pin Vader to retain the title. This was Shawn Michaels at his in-ring best in 96 and 90, especially 97. Nobody could touch him. Nobody, by 97, nobody could touch this guy in the ring. But it was also the peak of his being a complete prick and acting like a man-child, and that was on display here. He was visibly upset with Vader throughout the entire match, famously pitched a fit in the ring when Vader screwed up a spot where he was supposed to roll out of the way of a Michaels move off the top rope. Michaels would land on his feet instead. Shawn did land on his feet, but Vader didn't roll out of the way, so it just looked awkward with Shawn just standing there. So he loudly yelled, "Move!" and stomped on his head so hard. He stomped on this fucking guy's head so hard. And then he cussed him out. I mean, my God. If Vader wanted to, he could have killed this fucker for that. But as it was, Michaels had already threatened his job, and Vader was just too paranoid to do anything about it. There had already been an incident at a house show in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where Vader was laying in, you know, his classic Vader blows in the corner. And Michaels starts, he grabs, I think, a headlock or something, and he starts having a conversation with him in the ring. And as Jim Cornette tells the story, Vader loses the match, of course, and he rolls out of the ring, and he is in tears. When he gets to the back, he is in tears. This big, tough guy has been reduced to a pile of tears. And when Cornette asked him what happened, Vader said that Michaels told him that if he yanks his hair that way again, he's going to get him fired. Now, I still think this match here at SummerSlam was a good match, but that's just how Michaels was back then. He was a diva. He was all pilled up a lot of the time. This is well documented. But there was nobody better in the ring, so he could get away with it because he was that good. And Vince McMahon didn't well want him walking in over to WCW and joining his friends. He definitely didn't want that. So he was able to get away with a lot of shit that normally people would not be allowed to get away with. You wouldn't be allowed to get away with that today. Coming out of this, Michaels did not want to work with Vader anymore, which derailed plans for a rematch at Survivor Series. I mean, those plans were probably already abandoned before this show because Michaels beat him clean. I mean, there was no debate whatsoever about this. Unless the storyline was going to be that Vader felt he deserved a rematch because he had already, won the match twice. I guess they could have played that up if they wanted to. But Vader was to have gone on to Madison Square Garden at the Survivor Series and win the championship, but Sid got the spot instead. I did think it was very strange how they named the In Your House pay-per-view that December. It's Time. Remember they gave the subtitles to all the In Your House shows? That one was called It's Time, which was a play off of It's Vader Time and his theme music. So not only did he not get the championship, he didn't even wrestle on that show. He didn't even wrestle on that In Your House show. But I believe it. I believe the original plan probably was for him to win the belt at the Garden. Jim Ross just talked about the Vader and Michaels stuff on his Grilling JR podcast the other day. He goes, there was another issue with Michaels having, problems with Vader. And this I can at least understand. Vader never washed his gear until he went home. This is what JR said about it. Hat tip to 411 Mania for the transcription. Shawn explained to Vince why he did not want to work with Leon. I remember one time I had to chew Leon's ass out because he didn't take it seriously that you've got to wash your fucking gear. You can let your sweaty gear sit in your travel bag between bookings When the loop is over, you go home and wash your stuff. Leon had a propensity to leave his stuff in his bag. I had a phone conversation about him with that one time, and I learned from it because he put me on speakerphone. I chewed his ass out with his wife listening, and she ironically agreed with everything I said. Sean got in my face, so to speak, and said I'm not going to work with him whether you book it or not, because he won't wash his gear and it stinks, and then I get that stink all over me. All that shit was necessary. You've got an athletic monster heel with universal name identity, but because one guy got his feelings hurt or he was too stiff, he talks about how Leon was a good signing. Had he slowed down a little bit? Yes, but he had lost some weight. He was trying to get in decent shape. Sometimes when you're big like that and gassed, you can be a little stiff inadvertently. I'm going to talk to Vince. That was Sean's go-to, he says. I'm going to talk to Vince. It was just so unfortunate, childish, unprofessional, and should never have happened. I'm glad over the course of time that Sean has changed and he is not that overbearing guy that was always seemingly at the center of controversy. I'm glad he has changed for the better. Leon missed out on the title, and Sid was seemingly, for Sean anyway, less of an evil. 22 years ago this week, on August 22nd, 1999, SummerSlam came to the Target Center in Minneapolis, the state being governed at the time by Jesse the Body Ventura, who had shocked the world 1 year earlier by winning the gubernatorial race in Minnesota. WWE reached out to him to see if he might be interested in appearing on the show as a guest referee for the main event, and surprisingly, he was. Even after suing the company years earlier and winning. The appearances that he made on TV in the weeks leading up to the show were his first in 9 years, although he did later on cop to having an ulterior motive for taking the gig in a shoot interview that he did in 2012. I believe it may have been the RF video one that he did. He admitted one of the reasons he came back was to stick it to Hulk Hogan and Eric Bischoff. He said Bischoff had backstabbed him after Hogan signed with WCW in 1994, and they had subsequently fired Ventura. And his issue with Hogan has been documented in this very segment before. Vince McMahon admitted under oath in a deposition that Hogan was the one who ratted Jesse out when he tried to get the WWF roster, the locker room, to unionize in 1986, right before WrestleMania 2. Al Snow and the Big Boss Man took their hardcore title match outside the Target Center, across the street to a local bar, or a nightclub, whichever it was, called Blues Alley, which has since been closed. I was curious. I went on Yelp just to see if that place was still open, and apparently it's not. I loved it when they would leave the building and do stuff like this. I always thought it was fun. Ken Shamrock beat Steve Blackman in a Lion's Den weapons match. In the show-stealing match of the night, this is one of my favorite SummerSlam matches of all time, Test beat Shane McMahon in a Love Her or Leave Her match, where if Test won, he would be able to ask Shane's sister Stephanie out on a date. This match was much better than it had any right to be. Given the experience level of the people involved, especially Shane. Pete Gass, one-third of the Mean Street Posse, said that the Posse, Shane, and Test all met for a good 3 days before this show to go over the match so Shane could memorize all of his spots. He basically pulled a Macho Man at WrestleMania 3, and it paid off. WWE was also trying to get Billy Gunn over at this time as something. He won the King of the Ring tournament, and they booked him to wrestle The Rock on this show in a Kiss My Ass match that ended with Rock rubbing Gunn's face in some large woman's ass that Gunn had brought to the ring with him. Rock was said to not be happy about working with Billy, and let's be honest, it was beneath him, even back then. Even The Rock, long before he became as big of a star as he is today, it was beneath The Rock to be wrestling Billy Gunn in a major match at SummerSlam. And Mankind pinned Steve Austin in a triple threat match with Jesse Ventura as the guest referee to win the WWE Championship for the third time and the final time of his career. Kind of a shock finish here. I was not expecting Mankind to walk out with the belt that night. It did give the governor, though, a chance to raise the hand of one of the babyfaces. there have been a lot of stories over the years that Austin, you know, didn't want to do the job for Triple H. He didn't think he was ready. But Austin did the job for him just 2 months later in a singles match on pay-per-view. So they may have just wanted to guard against Jesse being booed and not give people the obvious finish, which would have been Triple H winning. Or Austin winning, I guess. Either way. There was a funny spot in this match where Austin got tangled upside down in the ropes and he couldn't free himself. He was yelling for Jesse to come over and help free him, and Jesse didn't hear him. So Triple H had to come over and help Austin out of the ropes. Triple H did win his first WWF title off of Mankind on Raw the very next night, which was also Lillian Garcia's first night as the new ring announcer in WWE. 20 years ago this week, on August 19th, 2001, SummerSlam was in San Jose with a series of WWF against the Alliance members. This was during the Invasion period, featuring a really fun ladder match with Rob Van Dam beating Jeff Hardy to win the Hardcore Championship, Stone Cold Steve Austin retaining the WWF title against Kurt Angle, despite Angle winning by disqualification. Austin has called this his proudest match as a heel. They were having a great match, but that finish was just a total groaner. And The Rock pinned Booker T to win the WCW Championship, the best part of which was the APA. I love this spot so much. The APA, Bradshaw and Farouk, they had had enough of Shane McMahon sticking his nose in this match. So they run down to the ring to go after Shane. Shane sees them coming and he starts sprinting around the ring. And as he is rounding the bend to get away from Farouk, he does not see that on the other side of the ring, Bradshaw is lying in wait. And as Shane comes around the bend, Bradshaw absolutely murdered him with a clothesline from hell. This was the best clothesline from hell I ever saw Bradshaw give. The fans popped huge for it, and it looked like he legitimately just killed this guy. 16 years ago this week, on August 21st, 2005, it was Icon versus Icon at SummerSlam with Hulk Hogan against Shawn Michaels. The two had been partners on TV when Michaels superkicked Hogan and turned heel on Monday Night Raw. Sadly, it was not a very long heel turn because Shawn was back to his old self the night after this pay-per-view, but for the few weeks that it lasted, it was nice to see heel HBK again. The in-ring promo he gave 6 days before this on Raw in Montreal is one of the best of all time. The heat that he got that night was just off the charts. There was also the Larry King spoof where Michaels dressed up as Hogan and mocked him for being old. Hogan was not amused by any of these segments and felt that Shawn had gone too far. Michaels claims that he got permission from both Hogan and Vince McMahon to say what he was saying, but then Hogan would turn around and go behind his back to management and complain and whine and cry about it. The original plan here was for these two guys to do a three-match series with Michaels winning one, Hogan winning one. Hogan probably would have won the last one too. But Hogan decided against it. He insisted that he go over at SummerSlam. That don't work for me, brother. Here's how we're going to do it. He out-politicked the politician. Shawn Michaels should have known better than to try that. What do they say? You come at the king, you best not miss? Hogan claims that Shawn's lack of professionalism is what caused him to back out of doing the other two matches. I don't know what unprofessionalism he could possibly be talking about. I mean, Michaels only flopped around like a fish out of water the entire match. His overselling of Hogan's offense was comical. It came across like a tantrum by somebody who knew that he was losing and wasn't getting his win back. And he admits now that it was not a very professional way to go about handling things, but the match was a rousing success at the box office. It was the second most bought SummerSlam pay-per-view of all time, behind only the Highway to Hell show in 98, and I think it was only about 50,000 buys less than that. I think it was about 650,000 buys for this show, I believe. Rey Mysterio defeated Eddie Guerrero in a ladder match for custody of Rey's son, Dominic. Mysterio has called this his favorite match from his WWE run. Eddie's wife, Vicky, was supposed to run in and push the ladder over at one point with Eddie on it, disgusted with his behavior. And eventually she did. She did do the spot, but she was sent out very late to the ring, which led to Eddie getting very vocally upset and shouting, "Where the fuck is Vicky?" Oh, I remember that. He was not happy. We saw some of that Latino heat coming out in that match. John Cena beat Chris Jericho to retain the WWE Championship in a match that Jericho personally requested. He wanted to put Cena over on his way out. He even extended his contract by a month to do the match at SummerSlam, and then he put him over again on Raw the next night in a You're Fired match before leaving the company. Jericho was completely burned out. He just wanted to just step away, and he did, and he would not come back until November of 2007. The same month that I recorded the very first episode of this podcast. This was also the show where Muhammad Hassan was originally being groomed for a World Heavyweight title match against Batista in Batista's hometown of Washington, D.C. You talk about the perfect setup, that whole Muhammad Hassan gimmick, not only beating Batista in his hometown, but his hometown happening to be the capital, Washington, D.C. I could see why they would have wanted to not only do the match, but possibly do the title change on that show. Now, he would have beaten The Undertaker at the Great American Bash in July, and there's a very good chance he would have gone on to win the championship. I don't think they would have decided. You know, those decisions about who's going to win are usually not made. I mean, sometimes they're made the day of, but probably at least the week of. I think even Bruce Pritchard has said that. Yes, they were going to do Hassan and Batista, but no, they had not yet, you know, confirmed that they would have done the title change. But yes, it is very likely that they would have. But the London bombings happened. On the very same day that they aired a taped angle on SmackDown the month before this, with Hassan leading a bunch of men dressed up as terrorists to attack The Undertaker, and UPN Network, which aired SmackDown at the time, said, "We don't want this guy on our network anymore. We don't want this character on our television show." And that was the last that we saw of Muhammad Hassan. 15 years ago, on August 20th, 2006, SummerSlam was live in Boston with Hulk Hogan, Ric Flair, Mick Foley, and DX all in action. Apparently they thought it was still the Monday Night War era. Undertaker was to have been on the show as well, until they moved his scheduled match with the Great Khali to the go-home episode of SmackDown for fear that Khali, with his knees being in bad shape, would stink out the joint. I think Khali with good knees probably would have stunk out the joint. Hogan wrestled and pinned Randy Orton in what ended up being Hogan's final ever, hopefully, WWE match. Ric Flair beat Mick Foley in an I Quit match, playing off the comments Flair made about Foley in his book, calling Mick a glorified stuntman. Batista beat World Heavyweight Champion Booker T by DQ, but not before the two men got into a very real scuffle weeks before at a mansion in California where WWE was filming a SummerSlam commercial. Batista had some heat on him for various reasons with other members of the roster. On his Heated Conversations podcast, Booker T said that he remembers being out in the pool that day with Tatanka. And you know, I had forgotten that Tatanka had come back and he had a short run on SmackDown in the mid-2000s. You know, Tatanka was the very first person that Miz wrestled in his debut match and who Miz beat. Miz's first win in WWE was over Tatanka. That should be a Jeopardy question one day. But they were in the pool, and he said when Batista showed up, it was like a cloud coming over all the beautiful scenery. And Booker went on to say, "What ticked Batista off with me was that I was always vocal with things. At this shoot, I told Batista, 'Hey man, let's just get this out in the open. I really don't like you. You really don't like me. But we got to work together. It's our jobs. We got to go and perform together. You know what I mean. But if you ever cross me, you're going to have to deal with these.'" And he put his fists up. Later on, he said, actually confronted each other like men. The fight went down, and I'm not going to get into too much detail, but I got fast hands, man. I'm quick with my hands. I remember when I was a little kid, I was about 13 years old, and I got beat up in my front yard. That was the last time I lost a fight. Needless to say, I put a good beating on that boy. Well, Fit Finley was there, and he has a different take on this. He got called into the room to help try to break things up, and he told RF Video, I don't know what started it, but they were rolling on the floor. They will say that Booker T got to Dave, but that's not how it was. Dave was on top of Booker. Booker T had a swollen eye. When we pulled it apart and stood them up, Charmel kicked Dave right in the nuts. Nobody will tell you that, but she snuck a kick in and kicked him right in the nuts. And he didn't sell it. Booker was threatening, I'll come to your door, I'll find you in the dark. And Batista, I don't know why that's so funny to me. He should have used that on TV. Batista said, no, we're going to sort it out right now if this isn't over. It's got to be over after that. But Dave did not get beat up by Booker T. That is probably the main story out there. But that is wrong. And so that is according to Fit Finley. And who are we to argue with Fit Finley, right? 13 years ago this week, on August 17th, 2008, SummerSlam from Indianapolis was the first WWE pay-per-view of the PG era, which, funny enough, included an angle with man-on-woman violence. There was a great feud during that year with Shawn Michaels and Chris Jericho that they largely booked themselves. They largely wrote and put that whole thing together on their own, which is probably why it was so good, right? You got two veterans like that working together. It's kind of hard to screw that up. So at the Great American Bash pay-per-view the month before this, which I was there at that show. I think that was the last time that the Great American Bash name was ever used as a standalone pay-per-view until, I guess, NXT resurrected it many years later. But according to Chris Jericho, after they did the angle on that Bash show, they did a match and they did an angle where Sean's eye got busted open really badly. He had a bad eye injury. And according to Jericho, Vince McMahon wanted to blow the whole thing off at SummerSlam. They wanted to have one last match, and that would have been the end of it. Shawn Michaels is the one who argued against it because he didn't feel that putting their match on underneath, there was a Hell in a Cell match that night. There was a big John Cena-Batista match that night. They didn't think that that would be doing the feud any favors. It would almost be doing it a disservice. And so Vince, in the end, agreed, but he wanted there to be some angle or segment or some form of continuation on the show in their angle. And what that came in the form of was a segment where Shawn Michaels was basically in the ring to give a retirement speech and say that he talked to doctors who said that he should not be wrestling anymore. He could lose his vision. It could just, you know, it could be a catastrophic situation. And he stood in the ring next to his wife, Rebecca, right? The former Nitro girl, Whisper. Chris Jericho comes out and he demands that Michaels admits that Jericho is the one who ultimately retired him and finished him off. And Shawn said that he would tell his kids that it was Chris Jericho's fault, but only if Jericho could go home and tell his family that he could never be Shawn Michaels. That's a sick burn. Jericho went to go punch Shawn in the face, but he ducked, and Jericho clocked Rebecca. She got a fat lip from a punch that connected a little too snugly by Chris Jericho. And her involvement was Shawn's idea. So you can imagine how guilty he must have felt that he put his wife in a situation where she got punched in the face. And Jericho obviously felt very guilty about it backstage as well. Until, as Rebecca was being checked out by the paramedics, she suddenly sat up and said, "Is that the best you got, Jericho?" And then the two of them felt a lot better about it. Now, during the August 11th episode of Monday Night Raw, WWE conducted a text message poll asking fans who they thought was the bigger star, John Cena or Batista. And Batista lost. I mean, I think we pretty much would have figured that John Cena would win, but he won in a landslide, 73% of the vote. And according to the Wrestling Observer at that time, WWE wanted to do something to bring Batista up closer to Cena's level as a top guy. And their way of doing that was to make a match between them as announced by the new Raw general manager, Mike Adamly, that these two would be having a match at SummerSlam and give Batista a clean win over John Cena, which is what they did. Now, Cena came into the match with a bad neck. They did a powerbomb spot during the match where Cena was going to be coming off the top rope for that top rope leg drop that he does, but Batista caught him and powerbombed him. On television, they credited that spot, that move, with injuring Cena, but Cena was already hurt coming into the match. He worked some house shows the following weekend after this pay-per-view before undergoing surgery to remove a piece of bone that was blocking a nerve in his neck, and he was back in the ring less than 3 months later at Survivor Series. And in the main event, Undertaker defeated Edge in a Hell in a Cell match to close the book once and for all on their feud. I have to go back one of these days and rematch this, or not rematch, but rewatch this and their WrestleMania 24 match, see which one I like better. They were both very good matches. I just don't recall offhand which one I would say was the better match. Post-match, Undertaker teased leaving the cell, but then he goes back into the ring and he sets up two ladders, and he proceeded to chokeslam Edge off of the ladder straight to hell, down through a gimmicked part of the ring that gave way. And then fire exploded out of the hole. So, you know, they wanted to get this visual like Edge had literally been chokeslammed down to the depths of hell. Edge, in an interview much later on, admitted that what he wanted to do for the big finale was have Undertaker tombstone him on top of the Hell in a Cell. And they probably had visions of what happened when Mick Foley and Undertaker were up there years earlier. Edge got talked out of doing it, and that's why they settled for the chokeslam spot. 8 years ago this week, on August 18th, 2013, SummerSlam was from the Staples Center in Los Angeles, but there was controversy the day before. WWE partnered with 2K Sports to host an event related to the upcoming 2K14 video game, the main feature of which was going to be this 30 years of WrestleMania mode. And to promote it, Jim Ross presided over a panel of WWE talent from different eras for a Q&A session with the audience. And Ric Flair was part of that panel. Ric Flair took over the panel. He was out there like a drunk uncle, talking about everything that the company probably did not want him talking about. He mentioned TNA. He talked about how John Cena drank a six-pack of beer every day. Now, this was only months after Flair's son, Reed, died of a drug overdose. He probably should not have been out there. I'm sure he was not of sound body and mind. He was not in the best mental space, probably, at that point. It's probably, you know, nice to be around friends and stuff like that, but should he have been out there in that situation, taking questions and doing the panel? Probably not. In hindsight, probably not. Flair had a WWE contract offer on the table that had been rescinded after this, and the month after, WWE fired Jim Ross. Now, they would claim that they came to a mutual agreement that Jim Ross wanted to retire. That's what they claim. He was retiring, which was bullshit. Say it with me now. Bullshit is what that was. It was their way of pushing him out. As I called it on Sound Off 292 at the time, this was the Stanford screwjob. Jim Ross got hosed. He took the fall for what happened here. They had sponsors and business partners there at the event, and they were left very red-faced by what had happened. Supposedly, the 2K people thought it was great. When Flair started going off and telling stories and stuff, they thought it was great. The WWE people hated it. None of this would have happened had it not been for Mick Foley. This all started when Jim Ross was going around the horn with all the wrestlers on stage, asking what their favorite WrestleMania moment was. And Ross intentionally skipped over Ric Flair because he was saving him for later on as sort of the main attraction. Well, Foley didn't know that, so he interrupted and he goes, "Excuse me, JR, you forgot Ric Flair." And JR said, "No, I didn't. I'm going to get to him. Calm down." And Steve Austin piped up and he told Foley the same thing. And Foley was like, "Well, hey, why are you all ganging up on me? I just thought I was doing the right thing." But JR had everything all planned out in his script, and then at that point, Foley completely screwed it all up. So they just went to Flair. And that's when Flair started popping off, and the rest is history. There is a certain irony that it was Jim Ross who got Mick Foley his job in WWE. And here you could argue that it was Mick Foley who unwittingly contributed to Jim Ross losing his job with WWE. But also on this pay-per-view, Bray Wyatt made his in-ring debut as part of the Wyatt family against Kane in a Ring of Fire match. We had Brock Lesnar and CM Punk and John Cena against Daniel Bryan. This was a double main event. These were two of the best matches in SummerSlam history. This was an excellent show, largely off the back of these two matches. Brock Lesnar and CM Punk had a no disqualification match against each other that I believe I called that the match of the year in 2013. I thought this match was fantastic. Now, Punk was not too thrilled about losing to Lesnar because he had already done two jobs for The Rock and he did one for The Undertaker, and now they're going to have him do another one for another part-time performer. And he felt that it was hurting his value. But he was a team player and he did it anyway, and guess what? They had a great match. Love this match. John Cena and Daniel Bryan, I loved that match in a different way. It was a totally different type of match, but I loved it all the same. Triple H was the guest referee. John Cena worked the match with a partially torn left triceps. It looked like he had literally a baseball in his elbow from all the fluid that built up when he showed it on TV. It was gnarly. But they had a great match, and Daniel Bryan did the running knee. The Busaiku knee, or as they called it for a while, their knee plus, which thankfully that didn't stick. Because he was the B-plus player, so he has knee plus. Anyway, Bryan got the pin. He won the WWE Championship for the very first time. And then came the big Money in the Bank swerve, where Randy Orton, who was the briefcase holder, came out and he teased cashing in, but then he turned to walk away. And with his back turned to Triple H, Daniel Bryan got spun around and pedigreed, and Randy Orton came back down to the ring and he cashed in his Money in the Bank and he pinned Daniel Bryan to become a 7-time world champion. This was the beginning of the authority. This was the start of the authority angle on TV, and this was the first time that Triple H was a heel since 2006. But this was the kickoff to what ended up being Daniel Bryan's journey to the main event of WrestleMania, which was not the original plan. It worked out that way. He was going to wrestle Sheamus, fifth or sixth from the top at WrestleMania that year, in Bryan's own words. But there was a confluence of circumstances, including Punk walking out in the company, that ultimately led to Bryan getting his big moment. But it all kicked off here. And even though Bryan only had the championship for a few seconds, I love this match. I love this angle. It had been a while since we had one of these surprise twists like this, and I just remember thinking this was so well done. On Raw the next night, John Cena announced after his loss that he would be undergoing surgery for his torn triceps and would miss 4 to 6 months. He was back in two. And later on in the show, Sin Cara, the original Sin Cara, not Hunico, he suffered a dislocated ring finger early in his match against Alberto Del Dipshit. The match was immediately stopped, and Del Rio was declared the winner. He was not happy about it, though. Are you kidding me? He's looking at this guy going, "You got a boo-boo on his finger? Are you kidding me?" So he went after him, and he's kicking his ass, even though the match is over. The referee had to push him out of the way and say, "Stop, the guy's hurt." And look, the reality is this. I mean, you could say how it looks that the guy hurt his finger, as compared to other guys who will, you know, tear muscles and they'll finish the match. Well, guess what? Tearing a muscle and finishing a match is stupid. It's a stupid thing to do, okay? It is very dumb. It might make you tough, but it is a stupid thing to do. And he had enough sense to go, "Look, I'm hurt. My fucking finger is dislocated. We just started this match. I can't finish the match like this. It hurts. Let's stop the match." Well, Del Rio didn't see it that way, but Del Rio didn't like him to begin with. There was already heat there between him and the original Sin Cara, so I'm sure he was more than happy to kick the crap out of him for real which is what he did when this was over. It would be the original Sin Cara's final match on WWE television before getting his release before WrestleMania the following year. 7 years ago this week, on August 17th, 2014, the first pay-per-view to adopt the WWE Network-style logo that is still used to this very day, replaced the old Scratch logo. This was the first SummerSlam where every championship that was defended, and I think there were only three of them, but every championship that was defended changed hands. Dolph Ziggler won the Intercontinental title from The Miz. Paige won the Divas Championship from AJ Lee. We had Stephanie McMahon back in the ring for the first time in a decade, beating Brie Bella. And then we had John Cena defending the Undisputed Championship in the main event against Brock Lesnar. This was months after Brock Lesnar became the man to beat the streak at WrestleMania. And John Cena had stepped in to win the championship after Bryan, who won the title, Daniel Bryan, at WrestleMania, was forced out with a neck injury. He was forced to vacate the title. John Cena won the title. John Cena took Daniel Bryan's place in this match. The destruction that we saw here in this match, that would have been Daniel Bryan at SummerSlam, not John Cena. And a lot of people who loved this match, like I did, I thought it was great. It was something we had never seen before. I'd never seen a main event, you know, performer in WWE allow themselves to be annihilated this way in the main event on pay-per-view. We had never seen a one-sided ass-kicking like this with a major star. This was Suplex City. This was the debut, basically. Well, I mean, it wasn't the first time he mentioned Suplex City, but for John Cena, it was the biggest trip that he had taken to Suplex City. It was 16 of them, I think, he took in this match before Lesnar finished him off with the F5. I think the first time Brock actually yelled Suplex City, bitch, might have been... Maybe it was the first time that they started talking about Suplex City. I don't remember now. I thought it came after he shouted it out in the Roman Reigns match, but that came the year after this, so maybe my timeline is off on that. But anyway, the point is, I love this match. I thought it was great watching Cena get squashed. I was not expecting that. But had it been Daniel Bryan, I think a lot of people's opinions might have been a little bit different if his big babyface run had come to an end in the way that it did here on this pay-per-view. And 5 years ago this week, on August 21st, 2016, SummerSlam was held at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn, New York. One of the greatest matches in SummerSlam history, AJ Styles getting a clean win over John Cena in an excellent match. First Universal Champion was crowned on this show. We had the introduction of the big, ugly red belt. It was Finn Balor against Seth Rollins. Balor had beaten Roman Reigns on Raw to earn the shot to challenge for the championship. It was the buckle bomb into the barricade outside that resulted in a torn labrum for Finn Balor, but he finished the match. I don't think he realized how hurt he was. He was able to finish the match. He won the championship. He became the first ever Universal Champion. And then he had to forfeit the title on TV the very next night. And he had to undergo surgery that kept him out for 7 months, but not before finishing the match and going down in history as the very first Universal Champion. And we also had Randy Orton one-on-one against Brock Lesnar. This was the blood stoppage that they did for the finish. Lesnar just cut him open with one of his elbows. You know, they were trying to go with a shocking finish. Shane McMahon came out. Lesnar confronted him. It was a definite tease for a potential match between the two. Dave Meltzer said the original plan for WrestleMania 33 the following year was Brock Lesnar against Shane McMahon. He said that once they brought in Bill Goldberg later on in 2016, and he decided to stick around for more than just that one match at Survivor Series, those plans were discarded. They went with Goldberg against Lesnar instead. But Lesnar also supposedly had no interest in working against Shane McMahon. So it's very unlikely that match would have taken place anyway. Can you imagine Brock Lesnar having to sell for Shane McMahon's punches? I could see why he wouldn't want to have any part of Shane McMahon. He's not afraid of him. He's afraid of his fucking punches. He's afraid of all of his credibility being flushed down the toilet. On Raw the next night, as I said, Balor relinquished the Universal title, and Bayley made her full-time main roster debut. She was introduced by the Raw general manager, Mick Foley, to confront Charlotte Flair. And that is this week in wrestling history. Just 2 weeks left. That's all we got. Next Sunday and then the following Sunday, September 5th, is going to be the final week of this week in wrestling history here on the podcast. I revived the segment back on episode 668 after a six-year absence, and we are about to hit the one-year mark, and so the segment will go away. I'm sure we'll cover other history stuff in various forms in the future, but looking forward to getting back to more of your mailbag questions in place of this segment here on the podcast. So enjoy these final 2 weeks, and if you would like to, you can always refer back to them on YouTube. I post every single history segment in a playlist on the YouTube channel. They're all organized in one long playlist. If you ever want to refer back to them for your listening pleasure, or if you are curious about something, you want to do some research, you can go ahead and refer back to those. And like those videos, too, because every time you like the videos, it helps the channel out. So that would be cool if you would do that. I am exhausted here. I'm gonna get out of here. One thing I will say, I did watch the first episode of Heels on Stars. That's that new wrestling show with Stephen Amell from Arrow. Amell is a real wrestling fan. He's friends with Cody Rhodes. He came in and did a match once at SummerSlam, you know, for WWE. He is the star of the show. He really is the one who owns and runs this independent wrestling company. I thought it was good. I enjoyed it. I'm going to tune in to the second episode, probably not tonight, because I'm going to be covering TakeOver, but I will, you know, try to catch up with it and watch it tomorrow. You know, he runs this promotion that isn't exactly doing great business-wise, and his brother is, you know, he's a wrestler as well, but his brother really is this main babyface attraction on the show. And it's as much really about the relationship between the two brothers as it is about wrestling. It's like the show is cloaked in pro wrestling, but it's about this relationship between the two brothers. I'll tell you what, one thing I could do with less of on the show, just based on this first episode, are all the references to the script. They throw that word around a lot on this show. People don't go around talking about the script. And I doubt a lot of small-time indie promotions spend time literally typing out scripts the way that Amell's character was on this show. He looked like Doogie Howser sitting there in front of his laptop getting ready to type out the whole script. To me, that just came off as goofy. Like they just wanted to beat non-fans over the head with the idea that, you know, there's always a script, like it's WWE or something. But, you know, outside of that, again, I don't have too much to critique. I enjoyed it. The fact that he decided to do what he did at the end of this episode was funny to me. I don't want to give it away. I don't want to give away what he did at the end of this episode. You can see for yourself. But CM Punk is going to be appearing on episode 3 of Heels next Sunday. So he's not on the episode tonight. But he does debut on the episode next week as an indie veteran named Ricky Rabies. That is his name on the show. So we'll see what his acting chops are like. I haven't seen any of the independent movies he's done. I know I think he was in one or two horror films. There's one called like Jacob's Girl or Jacob's, I don't know. I forgot what it's called. I haven't seen any of his work. We'll see how he is on the show next week. That's all I got. Follow me on Twitter at Solomonster. I've been live tweeting all week, all weekend, all the big events. I'll be doing more tweeting tonight during TakeOver. We can interact on there. Follow me on Instagram. I'm posting more on there. The Solomonster is my handle on Instagram. And if you would like to become a channel member on YouTube, as a lot of other people have done this week, you can go to any of our YouTube videos. You'll see the join button. Click that button. It'll give you all the details about the different awards, different perks that are on there. There is a one-hour Q&A video I did answering your questions on there from last week. So if you're a channel member, regardless of tier, you will have access to that. And there's more retro audio coming. Maybe not this week. I feel like I'm going to have to just sleep the whole week. I am so tired right now. That's why I'm still recording the podcast. I want you to know it is 4:10 p.m. Takeover is starting in about 3 hours. I haven't eaten anything. So I'm going to try to get this up as quickly as I can. This is the latest I've done a sound of. So I'm going to try to get this up as quickly as I can. I hope you're enjoying all the content. At least if I know you're enjoying it, then I know it's worth it. So drop me a note. Let me know. It'll put a smile on my face as long as I know you guys are having fun and enjoying it. And I'll be back with you for episode 719 next Sunday and live on YouTube tonight for your NXT TakeOver 36 coverage. Until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week, and we'll do it again next Sunday. Take care, guys.
The Solomonster sounds off.
Imagine if there was an NXT in 1990 and Mark Calloway finally found a gimmick that worked for him. He starts dressing like The Undertaker. He looks like a star. And then one day, he gets the call that every wrestler waits for. He's been booked for the Superstars taping. Only when he gets to the building, there's no smoke machine. There's no Paul Bearer. There's no urn. They've completely stripped away all the elements that made The Undertaker work. And then they book him in his very first match to be rolled up and pinned by fucking Hillbilly Jim. If these people booked television back then the way they do now, they would have been lucky to have any stars.
The Solomonster Sounds Off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolomonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow The Solomonster on Twitter @Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solomonster Sounds Off.